York Times, the Mongolian Times, the Financial Times, all of them, page one story. Nati wasn't the new Minister of Finance. It was Dickie Lady's outstanding chairing of the meeting. And I'm told the DA behaved, so there's a statement being issued by the ANC to say that Dickie Lady should take over from this old man who's got no hair, Monle. Well, I shouldn't say that because you also don't have any hair. I got a bit. And a grey beard that has been around for too long. The only difficulty is Dickie Lady doesn't qualify to be a youth. So, but still, compared to me, she is. Thank you, Dickie Lady, for your wonderful representation of the committee last week. Over then to the DM. We're looking, for the first 1.5 hours or so, we'll focus on National Treasury. We also have the team from SARS here, led by the Acting Commissioner. We know almost all of them, for the remaining 1.5 hours. So, DM, normally, you know, if the Minister or Deputy Minister are here, and let's take this opportunity as a committee, maybe you didn't have time to last week to congratulate the appointment, congratulating the new Minister for his appointment, Tito Mboweni, and I'm sure we'll see him next week, Thursday, presumably, and before that, obviously, in the House. So over then to you, DM. You might want to give an overview for a few minutes, and then we hand over to the DG.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable members of the committee. Of course, as per the invitation of the committee, we are here to account on our annual performance. Just one or two issues that I wanted to raise, that and having analysed our performance, in particular from the point of the AG's findings, we are all in agreement as Treasury that this is a wrong space for a Treasury department. But we derive comfort from the fact that being the situation that way, we are comfortable that there's nothing untoward. It's mere discrepancies of aligning with the technical requirements of the AG. We are comfortable with regard to where the resources were to have gone. And we really are committed to make sure that Treasury stays an example on this matter, but we'll engage on details as we go on. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. Good morning, colleagues. Chair, I'm not alone. I'm with a team of officials from the National Treasury. We have excused the budget group colleagues from Public Finance, Budget Office, Economic Policy and Assets and Liability Management, as you may be aware that we are busy with finalizing the medium-term budget policy statement. So, but what we have, we've got core teams from the Treasury responsible for this area and who'll be able to interact with the committee on key matters. I thought, Chair, right at the beginning, maybe let me make a two-line sort of statement that is important, that actually defines what we do and how we do it. And it's important that we come across like this in all our engagements, just in line with what the Deputy Minister said. We want to remain the custodians of the nation's financial resources. We hold ourselves accountable to the nation to discharge our responsibility professionally and with humility, with the aim of promoting growth and prosperity for all of us. We also aspire to excel in the quality of our analysis and advise in the execution of our financial management responsibilities. We aim to realize the full potential of South Africa's economy and people, and we want to mobilize the resources for the state in order to actually meet our obligations as a country, including partnerships with business enterprises and wider community in a very trust and mutual respect manner. So I thought, Chair, I must just highlight that these are the same principles that we believe in. We still have 10 programs as part of our work, but only in program 9 and 10 are transfers from the National Treasury, that's insofar as military pensions and transfers to GPAR's consent. We report on 6 outcomes, outcomes 4, outcome 6, outcome 5, 9, 11, and 12. I think it's also important, Chair, to just realize slide number 4, that upfront in the annual report, I'm lifting up the importance of really highlighting the fact that since 2008, the economy and global economy in general has been disappointing, and this has negatively affected and impacted by the global weak global environment and domestic constraints that as a result of drought, low commodity prices and uncertainty. I was in Bali a few days ago at the IMF World Bank meetings, and clearly weakened trade tensions are going to make really emerging economies very difficult for them to operate. In our own case here in South Africa, Chair, the contraction in our public finances is placing tremendous stress on us and our ability to finance public services, and this anyway threatens the affordability of planned expenditure. It's also not very, very ideal, but that's unfortunately the situation that we find ourselves in. We remain steadfastly committed to ensuring fiscal sustainability. I think that's something that's important, and that as we progress in terms of, again, our own reporting for the financial year that is at play here, we remain, we have to approach our fiscal, approach our fiscals and the management thereof in a fiscally sustainable manner. We have continued in the last financial year to work with all sectors of government, including the regulatory and structural reforms that ensure that growth is in place. The financial sector regulation bill was passed, and this committee was fundamental to it. Though difficult at the beginning, but finally the Financial Intelligence Center Amendment Act was successfully processed, and the provisions came into effect June 2017. We again worked with social partners. We focused on growing the economy. We've advanced inclusive growth and realizing economic transformation in many, many ways. I'll just mention one or two areas that were critical for us in the financial year and under reporting here. In our engagements with business, we managed to actually focus youth employment in a way that it has never been done before. With the partnerships that we have, we were able to launch the Yes Project. The President did that in the year, and that was clearly an area that we played a major role in. We will continue ensuring that the 30-day payment initiative is taken seriously at all levels in government. The African Regional Center of the New Development Bank was launched, which again is really making sure that the billions that we pay in this, we are able to engage very near with the bank. we have ensured that we enhanced our work in local government. We've got a city support program which is critically at the center of ensuring that our cities become centers of growth in the way they position themselves moving forward. And we're doing this obviously in terms of the urban integrated urban development framework that was set out by the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. We've identified 33 zones in the program that clearly will aim at redressing fragmented special reforms, and this is the work that we're jointly doing with COCTA in this space. We ensured that in the period under review here, identified 16 municipalities where we're able to ensure that unemployment, 425 unemployment graduates are funded through the Infrastructure Skill Development Grant to ensure that we enhance capacity building in the built environment, and I think this is work that we've done pretty well in the period under review. We will continue working with law enforcement agencies, ensuring that we address issues around how performance audits, including where necessary forensic investigations are undertaken. We'll continue providing that kind of support through our specialized audit services in the Office of the Accountant General, and in this area we've done pretty well. We focus on SCM technology, modernizing it to a point where we are able to see benefits in this space. In the central supplier database, as an example, we've got almost 656,000 users, 468,000 registered suppliers, 829 organs of state are participating, and there are almost 17,000 practitioners on board that generate approximately almost 30,000 daily reports. Now, this tells you that by just doing that in the period under review, we are able to see the benefits coming out of this, even though it's work that is continuing, that anyone who does business with the state should be, we should know who the person is, we should know who they are, whether they are registered for tax or not, and we should also ensure that they actually meet their tax obligations. So this is an important innovation from an SCM technology point of view that we're able to do. We'll continue ensuring that we build financial management. We've published the Municipal Standard Chart of Operating Procedures. We'll continue investing in the IFMS program and modernizing so that we are able to really ensure that post, we modernize our systems, we change, we deviate, we move away from the legacy systems that are difficult to manage, and we think IFMS in its own way will come with benefits that are needed. We'll continue working with state-owned companies in ensuring that they become financially viable, and this is a focused area. We did in the last financial year ensure that we strengthened the compliance of some of these state-owned companies, including changes that were introduced in the board, and this is work that we're doing. Overall, Chair, we still believe that we are in a good space despite the issues that the Deputy Minister raised up front around specific areas that are of concern to us. I'm going to direct members to slide number 5. And I'm lifting this because I've lifted it in my overview report right at the beginning about what essentially was the headline news about the 769 million rand of irregular spending. Now, Deputy Minister is correct. We should actually not be in this space. We should be a model of excellence insofar as these matters are concerned. So that number doesn't sit pretty well with us. But I can comfortably say for now, without explaining ourselves out of the 769, that at least half of that refers to a memo that was mislocated by the time the audit process was undertaken. Now, we are not saying the AG was wrong in really lifting this thing, because from a compliance point of view, come 31st of August, this memo was not there, was not found, was not located. We were only able to locate a memo that was approved by the former Director General of around 369 million after the fact, after the reports were finalized. But we are saying that half of that could have been addressed in that way. Now, we will talk more as we come to this slide later in explaining some of the irregular expenditure that we're picking up in slide 23 and 24. We'll explain more. Again, let me again at this point, Chair, just take over explaining what is essentially in slide 23, and I'll give the CFO just to take us through together with Laura. Slide 23, we have fruitless and wasteful expenditure. So I thought right up front, let me explain these two matters, because again, we should not be in this goods in this space. We deliberated in detail last year about the 69 million rand worth of fruitless and wasteful expenditure. As you may know, it refers to license and technical support of the Oracle, that what we paid to Oracle for software licenses. And we did indicate last year that this is something that's again going to be with us the following. But what did we do after we reported to the committee? After we reported to the committee last year, we went back to Oracle. We engaged with Oracle at the most senior level, including their international, and we wanted to understand, because we, at the time, we are paying for licenses that will still be used in future, and we did not want to be found wanting. We also engaged with the AG further. We actually got a detailed written response that Oracle explained, and this was forwarded to the AG for processing with understanding what exactly is this wasteful expenditure. Now, I should hasten to say to the committee that since last year, when this time, in answering the question whether these licenses are being used or not, or whether they are lying in shelf, we are playing for something that we don't know, I should report to the committee that we are using the licenses, some of them, Because what we've also found out, we've got each individual department have had engagements with Oracle one way or the other and had other licenses that they are stopping, that they are cancelling. Those contracts are being terminated by various departments, and we have a list of such departments. We can make it available later to the committee, where we can demonstrate that the take-up of these licenses is ongoing. But however, what we are not taking away from this committee meeting is that it will remain fruitless in the explanation that the AG gave and in the understanding that we have around this particular matter. But clearly, as we said last year, savings will be realized. The savings are being realized in terms of the benefits that goes hand in hand with ensuring that we modernize financial management in the public service and the performance of the IFMS project. So, Chair, I thought, let me give this firstly just the overview in terms of where we are at, what space are we at as a National Treasury in relation to our work, our focusing on our work, and in relation to these two particular matters that were in the media last week, including what essentially is now and we are reporting today to Parliament around fruitless and wasteful expenditure and irregular expenditure. With your permission, Chair, can I request Laura to just take us through the performance now of various divisions in the Treasury, the performance of financial performance, and our CFO will do that, and then we can then close. But Chair, the Minister of Finance is here. I don't know if maybe I can pause and throw it back to you, Chair. I don't know how you want, but we can continue in terms of our presentation. Thanks.
We've already, as I said in an SMS to you last week, we're very deeply disappointed that the President didn't consult this committee on who he's going to appoint. But that having happened, we shall duly write to the President about our complaint in that regard, as if he hasn't got enough complaints on his desk. But nevertheless, we congratulate you on your appointment and we wish you well. And all of us here, I think I might say this, speaking for myself actually, will have differences of views on Mr. Nene's departure. But on the whole, we wish him well too. And I don't think a committee can take a decision on that, but we just wish him well, and we regret the circumstances in which he had to go. But we also acknowledge, very unusual for this post-apartheid democracy, and frankly, it shouldn't be unusual, he offered to resign. So I think rather than come to some collective position, we just wish him well. And I will, in my personal capacity, nothing to this committee, convey my own thoughts to him. But we wish you well, Minister. We know you're in at the deep end. We didn't expect you here, but we pleased you here. If you do want to say anything, you're welcome to say something now. Or you can speak at the end. And you know the procedures. You've been a minister before. So I'll hand over to you if you want to say something. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, for welcoming me here back to this chambers. When I left in 2009, I thought that was it. I had my share of public service. But somebody called President Cyril Madamela Ramaphosa had a different idea. So I'm back here and looking forward to working with you. And I very much share your sentiments about my predecessor. Quite unfortunate, but we have to move on. And I'm looking forward to working with you. I might not be long here because there's a Minister's Committee on the Budget that I might have to go to. So, but thank you very much for... I hope you'll be nice to me as a committee until the end of the year. There's something in the English tradition called the maidenness. Yeah, so I hope you'll give me the maidenness until the end of the year, and in particular the DA and the EFF, I hope you'll be nice to me. Thank you very much indeed.
Mr. Mania.
Chair, we certainly congratulate the new minister, and given the fact that he's been recycled, in his own words, his honeymoon is going to be shorter than most.
All right. Basically, we hope you'll also be nice to us, Minister. Before you leave, you want to say something to Claire?
Yeah, I'm just jealous that David Menya is speaking after the Minister has spoken, so I can't keep quiet as the ANC. Yeah. Though you have spoken on behalf of us. I wanted to welcome the Minister in a stylish way, because I have Kaspar Nyovest record and say, Tito Boen Shasha!
Minister, you'll have to go, obviously, but we should alert you as if the department hasn't. The tax bills that we currently have before us, as you know, we have to finalize and have over to the NCOP before we rise end of November, early December. Now, unusually, this year, because of the VAT issues, you'll appreciate the committee has been preoccupied with how we manage this process. Now, obviously, I think most of us in different ways are acutely aware of the desperate need to raise additional revenue. But on the other hand, as you know, Minister, with the increases in fuel prices, and now there's another one looming, with a whole lot of other job losses and so on, the committee, at least for now, until now, the position seems to be of the majority that we're very ill at ease, to put it mildly, about the VAT increases. I'm sure you are too. And we've had civil society here, the trade unions, COSATU and OLED, up in arms about it. There's a VAT panel that has been appointed by yourselves, your predecessor, and you will report next week through the MTBPS, and the formal bill you'll table with us, the response of National Treasury. All we can urge you, because we are not able in terms of the laws to require it to respond now, you'll do that next week with the bills you formally table. We urge that if you have this panel, it can't be seen by the committee or people out there that we're stringing civil society along. There have to be meaningful concessions. While we're acutely, excruciatingly aware that we have to raise revenue, the committee so far, to put it mildly, is very ill at ease with this. So we're just pleading that with the bills you bring next week, the formal bills, that significant concessions be made and that money be found elsewhere. And we think it can be done. We've said it repeatedly. We can contain expenditure. There's a lot of slot mismanagement. And the other thing, very quickly, Minister, we'll engage with you later. You have to go and there's other issues. But we're going to raise this now. We are obsessed, if you like, and we make no apology for this, about illicit financial flows. We think we have to close that gap. There are billions of rands leaving this country, and we cannot sustain this anymore. So that's our major preoccupation. So having said that, perhaps next week, or at some appropriate time, we can engage more directly with you on these issues. Thank you very much for coming. We know you're under a lot of pressure, and we wish you well for next week. TG, over to your team.
Thank you very much to the committee. I'll be focusing on the performance achieved by National Treasury for this particular reporting period. In total, we achieved 79.19% of our indicators, and of the 20.81% that we did not achieve, we partially achieved 16.11% and we did not achieve 4.70%. Whilst we report on by program, I thought the committee, as we have done traditionally for the committee on a quarterly basis, I've also given you an indication of each division's performance, given that the division does such different work and each division has such an impactful influence over the work of Treasury. And if you go through the table that I've provided, you'll see that economic policy completed all of their targets. Tax and financial sector completed 4 of 5. Budget office, 10 of 11. Intergovernmental relations, that is responsible for the relations between three spheres of government, 9 of 11. Public finance, 1 of 3. I will explain the reason why they partially achieved the 2 when I go into that particular program. Assets and liabilities, 12 of 16. The Office of the Accountant General has traditionally the most number of indicators for National Treasury. They achieved 26 of 33. The Chief Procurement Officer, 16 of 19. International Financial Relations, they achieved all of their targets. as did Program 7, which relates to civil military pension contributions to funds and other benefits. And finally, our Program 8, Technical Support and Development Finance Program Management, achieved 16 and 24, and administration 6 of 9. Before I go into the individual programs, I do want to remind the committee that National Treasury is piloting and introducing operational planning as an additional layer of our planning and monitoring methodology at Treasury. Operational planning is located at Chief Directorate level, which enables Treasury to better monitor the implementation of our APP indicators. We also are linking our operational plan to Chief Director's performance agreement. So there's an absolute link between institutional performance and individual performance in terms of leadership, as well as our Deputy Director General, who is linked to the operational performance of Chief Director. What this means is that you will see we will have fewer indicators in our APP this year as compared to last year, and last year as compared to the previous year. This is because we are correctly dropping the operational indicators that had historically been in our APP into our operational plan, and we are monitoring our strategic indicators. This is on the advice of DPME, who, when they evaluated our APP, indicated that we should have a review of ensuring that our indicators in our strategic and our APP are strategic, and that is why you see a fewer number of indicators. It does not mean that Treasury is not monitoring. In fact, we're monitoring more stringently at an operational level and at a strategic level. Having said that, I thought it was important to note, in terms of the performance audit, the AGSA chose three programs to do their performance audit on. They chose Program 3, which includes public finance and budget management, Program 5, which is our biggest program, financial accounting and supply chain management systems, which includes OCPO and OAG, and Program 8, which is the technical and management support and development finance. Of the three programs, we only had findings on two indicators of all of those indicators, and both of those were in Program 8. Effectively, this means Program 3 and Program 5 had no findings, and Program 8 had findings of the, if I can recall, committee, I think there were 24 indicators, they had findings on two. Both of those were in terms of specific measurability. In other words, how we articulated our targets as opposed to our achievement. Portfolio of evaluations, they said a portfolio was not measurable, was not sufficiently specific, although we did achieve that portfolio with two evaluations. And the publication of synthesis of reports, we had one synthesis report, and we understand the challenge there in terms of specificity. But that was because when we were in the process of completing the APP, the procurement process had not yet completed for that synthesis report to be conducted. And so therefore we were not sure if we would need two or one, and hence it was not specified. In terms of our specific programs, Program 2, which measures economic policy, tax, financial regulations, and research, they achieved 92% of their targets and partially achieved 8. The one that we partially achieved was because the consensus reaching around implementing the savings and retirement policies in Nederland took longer than we had envisaged, as stakeholder engagement often does, although we recognize that it is a pivotal part of the process. I have included for the committee specific areas where we believe our performance was highly impactful or we overachieved. I won't go through those specifically, but if there are any questions, the committee can ask me thereafter. I did want to indicate, I know there have been some concerns around the fact that we were no longer specifically doing the project around the 80 papers for IRSA. I did want to give the committee assurance that we are still doing economic research, and we are still doing research with the broader academic community. We have reconfigured that specific program, so we believe that it will add greater value into the broader academic environment and to National Treasury in particular. As to whether economic policy is still being provided, please be assured 25 economic models were maintained in the last financial year and 4 forecasts were developed. In terms of Program 3, which is public finance and budget, they achieved 80% of their targets and did not achieve 20%. In terms of public finance, I did want to indicate that 3 of their indicators that were partially achieved all refer to departments having delayed their requests or responses to public finance. Hence, the time stipulated for public finance to complete their work was then not complied to. So it is not that public finance is underperforming in terms of monitoring, but that we are seeing the consequence of departments either having submitted late or submitted requests. For example, on the day of a cabinet meeting, having submitted a request for cabinet for public finance to review. So I did just want to indicate that. In terms of assets and liabilities management, they achieved the 75% of their targets were achieved. We partially achieved 25%. And I would like to note, committee to note that in terms of the corporate plans and the annual reports that were not reviewed in the stipulated time frame, that in fact it was one. There was one annual report and one corporate plan that was not stipulated. However, our performance monitoring does not recognize having succeeded 99.9%. It's in terms of those targets, it's either all or none. It's how we articulate them, and we believe that is correct, that that they either have achieved or they have not achieved. In respect of the constraints that this program, the resource constraints that this program has been experiencing, we've reported it quarterly to the committee, and just to indicate to the committee that National Treasury has instituted a stringent process to identify which of the vacant positions will be filled, given our commitment to maintain the COE. However, given the resource constraints in this program, positions in this program have been filled, and therefore we are expecting to see that the administrative underperformance, i.e., where we could not complete certain applications within the stipulated time. So although the committee must be assured they were all completed, they just weren't in our stipulated time period, we are expecting those administrative challenges to be addressed in this financial year. Program 5, I would like to indicate that...
Laura, sorry, I don't mean to be rude. I'm just a bit worried, DG, about time, right? We're close to 40 minutes. We still have the CFO. If you can just focus on why you didn't achieve the 100%, on the partially achieved and so on. But we're getting the drift. There's a consistent pattern.
No.
So if you can be more pithy and precise, please. Sorry about that.
No problem. I did want to indicate, in terms of Program 5, that we significantly increased our achievements in Program 5. The previous financial year, we only achieved 64.58%, and this year we achieved 81%. So I think that's very important. And you can see the reasons for our underachievement. In particular, it was due to delays in procurement or due to constraints in terms of resources. Our program 6 achieved all of the targets as did program 7. In terms of program 8, in particular we had challenges with the jobs fund, and that was in the main, not exclusively, but in the main due to the fact that the last call for proposals was specifically targeted towards the agricultural sector. And due to the drought, we had a lower than expected response, and all programs were did not continue post-contracting and prior to implementation. Finally, program one is administration. We achieved 67%. And I just want to indicate that whilst I understand the committee has been informed that we've had changes in these indicators, it's not unusual in program one to have changes in indicators, given that we pilot a number of programs in program one in administration, or when that area has now become operational, we drop it to operational performance monitoring and focus on those new strategic areas. I've provided you with information on human capital, and if you have any questions, please do ask us.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to take you through the financial performance of the department. The first slide, which is slide number 19, basically highlights budget-related matters based on our appropriated budget. The first one obviously highlights the department that we had to perform or do environment on. 100 million was shifted to Program 10 as a transfer, Department Secret Service, and also 50 million to SARS and 109 million to Common Monetary Area. The savings, obviously, Chair, relates to 470 million based on the NDB and the savings that we made when we paid to foreign exchange. Cost containment measures were continuously being implemented by the department, as well as coupled with an underspending of about 220 million. Spending overall for the department was 98% on the appropriated budget, which included 10 billion that was transferred to the SAA in the year under review. The next slide, Chair, basically highlights both at an economical level, economic classification, as well as a program level, the spend of the department from appropriated budget and the actual. The highlights there, Chair, is that the saving on cost compensation of employees, the COE, related partially to transfers that were made during the year in anticipation of early retirement that will be obviously was rolled over to the current year. Next slide is just a graphical overview of what I've already highlighted on. We've received an audit opinion from the AG. Treasury received an unqualified audit with emphasis of matter, as well as been highlighted on the predetermined objective on our performance. There were also material findings which we would highlight relating to irregular expenditure, as well as the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. The slides that I'm talking about in 23, our DG has already highlighted on the matter of Oracle, in terms of the support and maintenance of the Oracle system. The one that follows on the irregular expenditure is details of individual irregular expenditure, mostly that were from the current year, which includes the memo that was not located during the time of the audit, as well as the legacy systems, which are being replaced by IFMS, where we were supposed to have tested the market. Chair, the last slide is on the remedial actions that the department is going to take in terms of how do we arrange or how to solve the transgressions that obviously were recorded in our annual report. Majority obviously is already on the way. We've handed over some of the irregular, actually almost all of them, to the internal audit, so that we go through the process of Accountant General's guidelines in terms of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, as well as irregular expenditure. There has been also some that will be clarified through the investigation that was conducted on IFMS, which has since been completed. It's just going through internal review processes. There has, as we've highlighted last year, Chair, that the committee that was formulated in the department continues to perform, to monitor and also help the department in terms of initiating controls that will prevent recurrence of irregular, especially, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, which obviously continues to perform, and it reports both to EXCO as well as to the audit committee. Also, Chair, I must highlight that there are various initiatives that are being implemented, some of it obviously on the records management in terms of improving certain financial controls to tighten the process and preventing measures to ensure the non-recurrence of transgressions that were since found from the previous years by the Auditor General as well as the Internal Audit Committee. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, just one small comment from the DDG responsible for corporate services. One line and we'll be done.
Thank you, Chairperson. As requested, DG asked me to just look at the presentation and uplift whatever area I think needs to be brought. Whatever area needs to be brought to the attention of the committee. I think all the previous speakers have really touched the nerve of our concern as the department in terms of areas of regression, more especially areas of irregular expenditure. And here I'm representing EXCO to give assurance to the committee that we are here to be held accountable, to answer questions that would give the committee the comfort that as much as there is this situation in the Treasury, but we are very willing and able to ensure that compliance matters, risk management, are brought to the acceptable level. So I'm not going to get into the detail. I would rather use the remaining time to respond to questions that we are anticipating. Thank you.
Thank you all for your inputs. Over to members. Just can I just say one thing, though, before, because the minister might leave. If it's necessary at all to say this, right? I've said this before, and I'm not sure to what extent the majority will identify with this, but let me say this. I've chaired five committees in this parliament, right, since 1998, and I've served another role for a five-year period. Now, we may have differences on policy issues, and so we should. The majority in this committee and the National Treasury. Sometimes there are even ideological differences. And this is not wearing my other hat, within the ANC, National Democratic traditions. But this department, in my view anyway, is really very, very good. And the quality of its reports, Minister, compared to the four other committees I've chaired, Tandy also chaired a committee, I think Nati also, far superior, whether we agree or disagree. And the quality of the input, this is not what I know in my previous committees that I chaired, the quality of what we get. It's a very hard-working department. It's a very skilled department. The quality of its inputs overall, from my subjective experience of chairing five committees now, is superior to anything I've seen, which doesn't mean that I personally agree with many things that Treasury says or does. But it's the majority that decides. So otherwise, you just say that you have a very good department, from my point of view, for what it's worth. Okay, right, questions, please. I saw Mr. Lisa's hand up, Tikeledi, Tandi, Mr. Mania. Anybody else? Ah, Peggy. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But just for now, in the first round, thank you.
Tandi, you listening? I never cry. Minister, congratulations from me as well. Good to see you with us. The impairments, DG, page 268. The impairments on SAA have been increased by 10 billion. And the payouts to SAA were 10 billion in the year under review, I think, if I'm right. Why are they being impaired? Because that pushes the impairment up to 23.4 billion on SAA. Is it then correct that there is no value left on the books of SAA if the impairments are then applied to SAA's investment value? And then why are we writing it off? What is then going to be the situation with the further payments to SAA which are required in terms of their corporate plan? I think those amount to 21.1 billion. Are we going to impair all those as well? So I just need clarity on these impairments, please. DG, we've heard a lot about the irregular and wasteful expenditure, and the explanations are received and understood. There is a somewhat curious word used of mislocated. I think in plain English that means lost. But we'll accept the spin on that one. but more seriously, in terms of the whole picture of this irregular and wasteful expenditure, has anyone actually been held accountable for it? The various explanations, I understand them, and we've heard them last year and we're hearing them again, but who's been held accountable? And then we move on to the condonement. If the condonement is not successful, if I understand it correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong, it has to go to SCOPA and there's got to be a condonement process that goes on there. What then happens? That comes out of your next year's budget, if I remember correctly. It's a huge amount to lose from your budget. What is the status of the condonement applications? My experience in SCOPA is these things take years and are very slow things. How can we speed this up? Then, ministers, both of you, I'm kind of directing to the DG, but the honeymoon is on for now. So DG and I have had many sparring sessions. So we're sitting opposite each other, and we'll. But I mean, obviously, I'd love to hear from the ministers as well. In terms of the borrowing limits, and Program 4 manages government's annual funding program. In terms of the borrowing, what are the kind of limitations that are in place at the moment on levels of borrowing? I know that they are in the MTBP, or in the budget process, the medium-term budget, there are kind of levels of borrowing which are forecast. But just that's a kind of loose question. But more specifically, Eskom is indicating it's going to push its borrowings up to 600 billion. Where does National Treasury stand on that figure? Is it something that National Treasury has approved? That's really the question. Then, on slide 3 is a one of your principal targets, or what you want to call it, but is enforcing transparency. Now, the loans to Eskom that have been negotiated from China, none of us know what the terms and conditions are. Where's the transparency there? Are you able to give us those terms and conditions? And if you're not, what are the implications then for the further the balance of the 370 billion that is been negotiated as coming from China in various forms, not to Eskom obviously, but in various forms. What is National Treasury's position with regard to transparency? Let's leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chairperson. Without taking away what you have said, I will also add to say Shasha and welcome the Minister. Chair, last week we met with the Auditor General, and I said to the committee that usually when you receive the report, you receive a close report with some few highlights of some challenges. And our responsibility as the oversight body is to unearth problems, not with the intention of policing, but to assist. And the report from the Auditor General, I think, has assisted us. I'm going to focus only on this document of the AG. And I became very worried, and I'm still worried, that from what you said, I'm with you, and I expect, and everybody else expect, and the public expect National Treasury to lead by example. And if National Treasury can make such mistakes, if National Treasury can be unable to follow its regulations, the PFMA and others, where are we going? Where are we really going? So I'll focus on page 3 of that of this document. The first one is, I think, a general problem that we have in the public service, the asset management, bullet 1. And it further says it was corrected. But towards the end of the statement, it says financial statements submitted for auditing that had errors and commissions. We once had taken a decision as government that we had a campaign of clean audit. If these other entities can have clean audit, why can't Treasury have clean audit? What are you saying to these other entities and departments if you can't do it yourself? Chair, there's also something here that is spoken about SARS. SARS awarding contracts without tax matters having been cleared. This is contrary. This is the core function of SARS. How do you do that? Really? How do you expect us to go to the people and say our government is delivering or answer these questions? And these are the institutions that we had hope that they understand what they're doing. So on the same page, with your permission, I'll just read that sentence. Bullet number 4. Some of the goods and services of a transaction value above 500,000 were procured without inviting competitive bids, and deviations were approved by the amount, by the accounting officer, but it was practical to invite competitive bids, as required by Treasury regulations. 16A6.1 and 16A6.4. Competitive bidding process was not followed. It further goes down to talk about the meeting of the minimum prescribed threshold. It was not done. The minimum. And interestingly, Chair, when I close, I'll also want to read this one because it gives me a problem. And I always, I shared with the colleagues last week to say in my previous life, I had an experience that once you don't take the Auditor General serious, you're going to have a problem. Once you don't take the Auditor General findings, you are going to have a problem. And the reason is because there's no consequence management. We are the oversight body, but we are just dogs barking without teeth. We can't bite. Who must bite? The Auditor General also report to SCOPA. Who must make sure that people are taking responsibility and heads are rolling? Because once we come to that decision, it will be business as usual. It will be the worry of the minister, because the minister and the deputy minister knows that they are going to account the DG and the others, ordinary workers, the food soldiers. The managers, they are not making them feel important that they are contributing towards the findings of the AG. That last sentence, last paragraph that I want to read, it says, effective and appropriate steps were not taken to prevent irregular expenditure amounting to 768.9 million rands, as disclosed in note 26 to the annual financial statement, as required by the section 36, subsection 1C, Roman figure 2 of the PFMA. And Treasury Regulation 9.1.1. The majority of the irregular expenditure was caused by non-compliance with supply chain. Just imagine. Processes. Supply chain. Non-compliance with supply chain in the National Treasury. The department. What do we then are we going to expect from sports and a department in the province or a municipality? Hence, maybe that's why the municipalities who banked with VBS didn't take you serious when you told them that it's wrong to bank with the VBS because it's not a bank. What do you call it? It's a mutual bank. So maybe that's why they don't take you serious. Because we just say it. My plea. Maybe, and I'm going to use to call you this, and I see you are uncomfortable, Minister. And Deputy Minister, as our colleagues, maybe also in the cabinet, you need to come up with, suggest something to us that will make people to account. No, not to shy scam to G. Because all those figures, but no, I'm so shy scam to your spin and your shy, and then your puma, your hambazo, and then. Comrade Moni, here's my throat. Consequence management. And that's what our people are expecting. Because we seem not to be taking this thing serious. It's just too much, Chair. I just want to highlight on this once. And I'm also going to request and plead with you, Chair, that maybe as a committee we should also take a resolution that can we please receive the plan from the department, from National Treasury and SARS, that are talking to these issues so that we can be able to monitor progress. We don't want to talk at the end of the year or somewhere where it's late, so that we can be together in the same thing. We want to be part of the solution. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
And thank you, Minister.
Thank you. Then it was Tandi and then Mr. Mania and Piggy.
Chair, thank you. Let me echo the sentiments of the ANC by welcoming the Minister and wishing him well in his new responsibilities. And before I make any comments, Chair, I don't know whether is it possible that in the near future, when we deal with this report, we extend our time of engagement so that we interface with the management notes of the AG in relation to the presentation that National Treasury makes on the annual report and their management notes, because that's where the solutions will come. So let me go to the issues. My focus is going to be on program two, the issue of the ICT project. Really, DG, National Treasury is always taken as a model department, and how we've dealt with the issue of ICT as National Treasury has not left an impressive mark in terms of modernization of the entire government system. And I've raised this thing before. Look, if, for instance, the AG argued that you don't have a business case to argue for IFMS, how then do you put rents and cents on a project that you did not build a business case? I mean, it becomes very nonsensical from the beginning. And that's why you can define irregular expenditure in different terminologies. I know what is irregular. It becomes irregular if a business case was not presented up front that will speak to that. And it's given the fact that there's a vacancy of a senior official that should have handled that. The sooner you deal with that, the better. Because then you'll have people that will understand why you lost money when you made upfront payments on the IMF system, because you had junior management who were responsible for a big project to overhaul the entire systems. And that should be a system that's going to be exemplary. And, well, I listened to you when you argued how other departments actually use Oracle. I raised a few years ago with you that you still use a very backward system. The corporate world used the most advanced system. So government officials should be up to scratch to be able to adapt to new conditions. And I'm saying this because this is a department that do forecasting, Minister. And it speaks to the next project, Laura. You see, the reason why, even if you have an economic research unit, you'll have a different perspective in terms of how you have dealt with forecasting is basically because of this. So there's an interlink between the two. So we need to have a very radical shift with how we're going to apply our minds in terms of the economic models we have. And I wish you luck, Minister, on this one, because like you, that you beg to deal with this specific one. And basically, you'll have to broaden the scope. And, you know, I used to argue in the past, for instance, we have a petrochemical company called PetroSA, which look at how the payments on the rent every 5 minutes. And if the systems are not as fast enough to look at how they do it globally, basically you're going to either under-focused, and it's going to lead to misstatements, because how you deal the systems that deals with that are not complicated enough to be able to grapple with the changes that the market makes all the time. So if you've got people who are a little bit tired in that sector, change them. Gigi, change them. Now, it comes to a point where we say, in relation to the APPs and the indicators, do you want us to go to a stand where we look at performance agreements of those individuals in terms of the performance? Because we need to be upfront on this one, that really they need to be changed. And I used to be fortunate when I used to work in government because there was a fellow called Nobin Gombani who used to force us, even when we were deputy directors, to sit in management to learn the ropes at an early stage so that as and when we deal with this matter at a higher level, we've already grappled with it. Because the changes that the GPME is presenting unto you is trying to grapple with the efficiency levels that are not found in the public service. So you'll have to be able to adapt as quick as you can. So the AG will put it as is in terms of how they measure performance, because that's a system that requested them to do, that beyond just looking at the rent and cents, let's measure the performance for us to be able to bring inefficiency in the public service. So you might want to give away that because of how they look at material findings. You've never agreed. You've never agreed. It's always the case. But they test it. That's why it's a material finding. So it's going to be irrelevant whether it's a qualification or not. The fact is, if there's a material finding that shows that our perspective in terms of how we projected our models was not efficient and adequate, then it put us at the best footing. And in terms of the economic sector, you're going to be found wanting. That's why academics are questioning your forecasting models. They came here, you know, they spoke very fiercely on the issues on how you tested the issues of the VAT, specifically because they hold a different view. And DG, we've got a charismatic minister, maybe he'll try to entice them and their views, and they'll find expression in our economic policy moving forward, and then it give us a different perspective altogether moving forward. And listening to the chair trying to plead with you on VAT, I don't know how much we can do with it. But when we speak on the management notes, we have improved on the software that we have and deal with that. Chair, let me not take much of your time today. And I need to say this up front. There's a temptation from our side to speak to decisions you take in terms of how you source funding, whether you're dealing with loans and stuff like that. But some of these things become sometimes market-sensitive matters as to how you're going to deal with it. But also, we need to also remind ourselves about a policy perspective we just took in terms of how we're going to deal with impairments and how you're going to write off matters in books. And we shouldn't speak from different sides of our mouth when it relates to state-owned enterprises, when we look at it in terms of how we fund companies who have not dealt adequately with their impairments. So it's some are political matters. We'll see how we deal with them at the later stage. It's a competitive environment, Minister. People will want to project their views as above those the ruling party might hold in the current country. But we'll deal with it effectively as we deal with the MTVS. So let me leave it at that, Chair. But we'll look at the management notes as we move forward and give us something different. Maybe in the next 6 months, as based on what the rest in terms of performance of GIPA and stuff like that. Those are things that you can explain in your own way, that sometimes it will not be acceptable from these quarters, but we know how it works in relation to how you dealt with procurement issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I have just three questions. I think it's common cause that the National Treasury that there's been a deliberate attempt now for nearly a decade to defang National Treasury. And so I'm hugely concerned about restoring and building and maintaining institutional strength at National Treasury. But I think everybody would accept that is impossible to do as long as, for example, at the apex of National Treasury, 4 of the 10 apex positions are acting positions. And indeed, the SARS Commissioner himself is in an acting position. So my question to the DG and possibly to the Minister, if he chooses to comment, is what plan, do we have a plan in place and I think the committee needs to feel a sense of urgency about filling the apex positions. Equally, is there a plan in place and a sense of urgency about filling the 25 vacant posts in National Treasury in the senior management service? Because there is a concern about the institutional strength of National Treasury now, Minister. And what worries me particularly is that for the first time in many years, there's now a question mark about the capacity of the modeling and forecasting unit. And institutional, major international financial institutions are starting to lose confidence in National Treasury's capacity to model and forecast. And I think that's a big concern for all of us. So that's the first question. The second question traverses the whole controversy surrounding VBS Mutual Bank. And in putting my question, I don't want to be misunderstood. The VBS Mutual Bank scandal took place because there was a criminal, if you like, enterprise at the center of VBS Mutual Bank, which we now know deliberately falsified financial statements and also falsified reports to the regulators, which must have constrained the regulators in their ability to regulate the bank. But also, we've got to concede, Minister, that from at least the 14th of October 2016, as a result of a parliamentary question put by my colleague Kevin Milam, we know, and it was a matter of public record, that the VBS Mutual Bank was taking illegal deposits. We knew that. Parliamentary question is in the public record and in the Hansard, and it's dated 14 October 2016. So my question is National Treasury and the regulator, is there any intention to conduct a review of the action taken by National Treasury and by the regulator with a view to learning lessons and possibly strengthening systems and legislation in order to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again? That's the second question. The third question concerns the PIC. I'm not sure if you're aware, Minister, but your predecessor issued a statement on the 15th of July this year saying that there would be an inquiry into the affairs of the PIC, which we support. Subsequent to that, there was a clarification on, if I recall correctly, the 16th of August this year, saying that the President would appoint a commission of inquiry. 3 months later, there is no inquiry and no commission of inquiry has been established. So I wonder if we could have an update on that matter, and if I could just make a final point about that. What's very concerning is that at least the scope of the commission of inquiry, as described in the minister's statement, appears to exclude any inquiry into questionable investments, which means in our view, at least from an opposition perspective, that whether there's an inquiry or a commission of inquiry, it's not going to be credible. So the scope is very important. But anyway, I mean, the thrust of my question is there an update on this matter? I realize, of course, if you're going the commission of inquiry route, that the matter probably rests with the presidency, but at least we could have an update. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Let me also add my voice by welcoming Honourable Minister. And of course, we wish you well, comrade. I must indicate, Honourable Chairperson, that we were quite disappointed last week when the Auditor General presented their report to the committee. Because we are indeed expecting National Treasury to be a model of excellence, but it doesn't seem so. I wish to start by supporting Comrade Dikeledi when he said he proposed that National Treasury should come and present a turnaround strategy about all the issues of irregularities that have occurred in the department. I wish to support that. Secondly, it is indicated that in Program 2, You have spent 92.6% of your 164 million rands budgeted for that particular program for this financial year. But the unspent funds, and the indication there is that it is because of the discontinuation of EFSA research and the decision to implement cost containment measures on various goods and services. My question is, does the Economic Policy Division have internal capacity to undertake economic research after the discontinuation of EFSA services? Do you have that capacity? It is important for us to know. My other question is, it has been our observation that most government departments do not actually comply with the 30-day payment of service providers. Many, many government departments do not really adhere to that particular policy. Do you have capacity to monitor, you know, that process? On slide, I think it's on slide 11, you have indicated that you have referred 50 cases to law enforcement agencies. You have referred 50 out of how many? Out of how many cases that you have identified? Thank you very much.
I'll be very brief because time's running fast out. Just to remind members, our approach is to have quarterly reports. So when we come to this review of the annual report, we have to relate the issues we take up here with the last quarterly report and last year's BRRR report. And the difficulty is, of course, that Treasury delivered its report yesterday, which for the last 300 years we've been raising with members of the executive, should be avoided, right? Once again, DG, if we can have the report by the Thursday before, it helps also with our researchers. Secondly, researchers, I don't think to apologize. They are under considerable pressure. Zakhele is still working, I'm astonished to learn this morning, for justice and correctional services. Still, after all the fights, right, with human resources manager. And mercifully, my term comes to an end shortly as a chair, if I survive till then, May or whenever the elections are. But one of the things in the exit report we should say, it's impossible for the content advisor of finance to also be the content advisor for justice. Those are the two largest committees in this parliament. Then the next thing is, comrades, members are very busy here, but some of the questions we're asking are covered in the previous year. It doesn't help, DG. We've said this repeatedly. What we would like you to do is to respond to the recommendations made last year. I know we've covered it in quarterly reports, but it's nice not to leave it to the content advisor's first draft, which we get and rework, right, according to what we need. Perhaps you can, by tomorrow, 10 o'clock, give us your response to our last year's report, right? Secondly, there are things that Antonia Manamela has raised in her report, which unfortunately on our side came to us last night or late yesterday afternoon. But as I say, Antonia can't do more. She doesn't have the formidable staff you have, never mind what Mr. Mania says of the vacancies. Poor Antonia is overstressed. So if you can look at her report and just reply to the issues she's raised. But Antonia, if you want to raise anything now in the meeting, please do, so they can respond. Then very quickly, on the AG's report, I agree with what the members are saying. That we see, you got a slide there that does actually present what you're seeking to do in reply to the AG's report. But I think you should add more. So again, by 10 o'clock tomorrow, if you want to add more on what you're doing, then what will happen is that the next quarterly report, comrades and colleagues, we will monitor progress in this regard regularly, okay? So that we link our quarterly reports with this BRRR. Then, very quickly, there's a lot of issues that have already been covered. Perhaps I should make the more general point, Minister, that when I said you have a very good department, I'm comparing it to others.
by far the best department that I have been involved in as a chair of a committee. But that doesn't mean that what Vicky Lady and others are saying are not correct, that you have to be exemplary. But to be fair to Treasury colleagues, we can't compare them to, let's say, a small department. They manage a huge amount of money. So when, for example, if let's say, I don't mean to be rude, but let's say the Department of Sport achieves only 75% of their targets, and a department like Treasury achieves 75% of the targets, I don't think it's fair to equate the two because of the magnitude and scope of what they do. But on the other hand, it's right to say what members are saying, Minister, Deputy Minister, DG, that Treasury should be leading in this regard. Then, I mean, there are many other questions there, but let's pass it by, except there are two things I think that should be raised. The one is on the PIC. Now, the committee in its report, can I recommend this already, unless people disagree, it's nothing to talk about, must strongly urge the President to define the terms of reference of this inquiry as soon as possible. We urge the Minister to engage with the President around this. Minister, at the time you left this Parliament and where we are now, as you'll appreciate, are two different worlds. We have a situation here where chairpersons are lumbered with tasks that fall beyond our mandate. So what happens nowadays is, every time an issue arises, people think we can convert ourselves into a commission of inquiry, right? We suddenly become, no, but Tandi, you agree with this. Let's separate the issues, Tandi. You yourself have been vigorous on this issue. So I'm speaking on Tandi's behalf, comrade. Tandi, speaking on her behalf, you know what happens here? Every time a thing happens, Steinhoff, okay? We must take over the responsibility of the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the Hawks, the NPA, right? We must take over the responsibility of the National Credit Regulator. Let's dissolve all of that. We must take over the responsibility of all these regulators that we established in the post-1994 dispensation. Let's take over. So then, Comrade Minister, we don't have a single auditor here in this committee. We'll have to look at, as I said on Steinhoff, hundreds of thousands of documents in 30 countries before we can come to conclusions. So on the PIC, a similar thing is going to happen now. Right? There's a demand, let's look at the annual report. Let's inquire into all these things, right? So, we will discuss that tomorrow and look at the program. What I'm saying is that it's not fair for the President and the Minister to stay in the public domain. There are two sets of inquiries before you've got appointed that we're in the air. One is a specific set of inquiries of a disciplinary character that look into the performance of the CEO and others, which some of us here wanted. Even if a person is innocent, and there's all these accusations about him or her, as we said about Mr. Makwakwa, why don't you say, I've done nothing wrong. Do carry out an inquiry to clear my name so my family and others, my children at school won't be feeling under pressure. Similarly with the CEO, we're not saying Daniel Machila's done anything wrong. Am I right? We're simply saying that there's a need for an inquiry because he's the CEO of such an important institution, right? Then the minister also said, and David Meaney is right, the president then said, we even got a letter from the minister to say, hold your horses on the two bills before the committee. The one is a private member's bill for Mr. Mania's party, or Mr. Mania at least, and the other is a committee bill. And I'm sure the department DG can apprise you of all of that, but at some stage perhaps we can meet. I can share with you some of the concerns of this committee as soon as you're ready for that. But I'm saying simply that the minister wrote to us, Minister Nene, in good faith, and said, guys, hold your horses on these bills, because we are having a major inquiry right into the PIC. And the inquiry is also going to look at all these issues. So won't you wait for that? So we said, unfortunately, we hear you, Minister. I engaged with him. There are some parliamentary norms and rules. Mr. Mania has been very patient. He brought his bill in December last year, is that right? But he's been kind enough for once. You'll get to know Mr. Mania. For once, he's kind enough to say, okay, I'll wait. But he has a right. There's a constitutional court decision on this matter. So we told Mr. Nene, Minister Nene, no, it can't be held back. What we will do is we'll proceed with the bills as we're going to do, but we won't vote on it until your
your commission does its work. Because that commission will be better able, you'll sit for hours and hours, it has got the technical expertise that none of us who pretends to have it. So I'm saying in short, Minister, if there's one thing we want you to do, is to urge the President to declare the terms of reference and move on this PIC inquiry. Please, we're pleading on that. On BBS, I just want to alert the members that I keep getting requests, and I refer them because the acting chair is effectively the chair. And, you know, right, no. And now, right now, as I'm seated here, there are two requests. I think tomorrow we should decide on when we're going to call the Reserve Bank and Advocate Mutau to our committee. We'll find a date and look at the program. Secondly, I think in the meanwhile, we can't fold our arms and say nothing. Right? So we should issue a statement. I'll draft something and we'll look at it tomorrow. So on VBS, Minister, look, I'll stop there. We're running out of time. Can I plead with the DG and his team and the Minister, if you want to say anything, and DM, since you chair the PIC, can you be precise, concise, but also, as usual, what we do is you can, by 10 o'clock tomorrow, do these written replies. Because we're under huge pressure, comrades, to vote on our report by Friday, and I want to raise that tomorrow about whether it should be Friday or Thursday evening and so on, but we'll come back to that. So in short, you won't be able to answer all the questions. Choose the themes. The major themes, as I see it, comrades, am I right, is around how can Treasury itself be responsible for wasteful expenditure, irregular expenditure, etc. Two is around the issues of, I think Dicaleri raised it very well on that matter. Then the other major issues are the thematic ones about achievement of targets, about, I think the PIC thing is very important, about the SCM, as somebody raised, about the IFMS, and then the rest you can do in replies, written replies. Can I also plead with the members to give me some direction? The House is not sitting today. I know the NC study group meets at 2. So can I plead that we finish at 13:15 rather than 13:00? Is that okay? Right, so extra 15 minutes we have. But we still have SARS to go. Thank you, DG and team.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yeah, we'll be brief. I think most of the responses will, as Chair is suggesting. But let me just assure the committee that, then I'm in the wrong profession. I think we must... I want to assure the committee, and Honourable Tikele is right, we are not here to spin ourselves out of this. We take the committee serious and we take ourselves very serious, because if we spin, then we've lost it and we don't belong here. So we will ensure that we take the comments serious around supply chain, and that we clearly we have to correct. These are lessons we have to correct. The capacity, Honourable Mayor, is dwindling in terms of what we know. Many reasons. Partly resources, partly people. ALM in particular, and Economic Police, those are key two divisions where all you need is exactly 18 months in the Treasury and you'll get double the amount of pay coming from university. If we get you from as an intern, in most cases in a division like ALM, asset liabilities. We get you in for 18 months, we expose you to the necessary work that we do, banks snatch you, and they give you 3 or 4 times what you earn. So it's not easy to keep going. Economic policy is the same. So the capacity is something that we take seriously. We have to continuously empower ourselves, continuously get people in and fill those positions in most cases. The ERSA was one of the institutes that we are into, 10 to 15 million a year that we are. I personally, and when I got a memo from the team that says, want to stop, I said, I'm not just going to approve like a normal administrator and just say, yes, we stop the relationship. I called two members in that committee and say, look, I want to understand, my advice is this, but what are you guys doing? Can we relook at this relationship? But in the meantime, I'm stopping the relationship. It's not that we are killing the capacity, but it's just getting us refocusing ourselves in a particular, because themselves, they had challenges as ERSA in terms of how they related among themselves. So we thought by just giving them 15 million, we could use it differently. And it's all, by the way, in the context of saying, can I use this 15 million differently in the same economic policy?
Just last week, we've lost one of the chief directors in the economy modeling section who joined the Reserve Bank. And now, again, that tells you that that division is we have to make sure that we continuously, keep people and keep them engaged, etc. The CFO who spoke about the impairments in the irregular and wasteful around the mislocation of the men. That's quite important, and I take it very serious. Because, and I know, now that I'm an accounting officer, I know someone will come with a memo to you, and you'll be in a meeting and say, DG, look at this quickly. Now, that memo will not, it will be recorded in the division where the memo originates from. It will be, an electronic version will be available. Now, if I sign, and I can imagine, and I'm not, again, explaining myself away here, it could be, because this memo emanated from the OAG, where Scout Human at the time was the OAG. Now, we have to check in its records, because the memo, the signed version will go back to the division. It has to be located there. And once the memo is signed, the reality and the email trail to that. Scout emailed it to everyone who was part of the memo. Now, the original is mislocated, is lost. You can't find it. I hope we'll find it still. But then we have an electronic version that suggested that, yes, it was circulated after it was signed to various people in the Treasury, and we've got a version that we could show. But again, as I said, it was after the due date. So we cannot, rightfully so, the AG acted properly then. Honorable Tandy is right, I think, around, and then the minister explained something fundamental that I never thought, by the way, that he's asking me, DG, did you ever invite the committee to the department, like the committee go to, so that you come, engage with us for the whole day, look at our models, let the guys explain what we do and how we do, because clearly, you've got a group of about 30 youngsters, not youngsters anymore, but 30 people in the Economic Police Division of the Treasury that do this work, that relate with industry, that physically go to industry in some cases, that relate with the Reserve Bank and many other economists in the country. And the kind of work that they do is, that's what we'll rely on. But at some point, we may want to invite the committee to engage with us in our own backyard to see and advise us differently, because as part of this building process, we have to. Honourable Mary, you were raising a question about all I can say with VBS, and we can talk about it. I think, for like any other forensic investigation and any other report that we interact with, if there are any lessons to learn, we'll do that. We'll learn how best we strengthen. I think it's more about strengthening systems, as the process unfolds in terms of what exactly happened there. But obviously from our oversight point of view, from the obligation that we have, including the regulator, by the way, we should be able to allow ourselves to actually modify and modernize some of the systems that we have. Honorable Peggy, we agree. I particularly welcome the fact that we have to maybe focus a turnaround strategy that matters, that we can share with the department in terms of we have to be a model of excellence. We cannot be tainted. Despite all the shortcomings, despite the challenges, we have to be in a position that we can become a model of excellence, and it cannot be us. That's why I started on that note. And say it cannot. And the Deputy Minister also started on that note to say we have to be exemplary out there. It cannot be that the department has got an amount as such as it is. And we can explain each as we try to explain, but, supply chain management cannot be in any way, flouted. And this is a concern. Zanele can just talk about the 50 cases maybe, or we can actually include it in our report tomorrow. I would end there. The rest I would then put it in the written report tomorrow. And I don't know if Deputy Minister wants to come.
I think are fair by raising my members. For example, there's a loan that the government's getting from China for ESCOM. Now, we haven't discussed this, right? But can you give us a reason why, in terms of our laws and constitution, and the PFMA in particular, I heard the president reply. I didn't hear him, I read it, I think, in News 24 online, about something to the effect that you can't release the information because I can't recall what he said. But can some explanation, DG or somebody, be given for what is the rationale, given our open, transparent budgeting process, And given the laws that apply, for government to say you can't release that information, what is the rationale? It may be correct, I don't know. I'm just asking in terms of what law, in terms of what rule or what norm, is it not being released?
I agree with you. I think as a principle, Chair, and with, you know, as a direct response. No, because I've just said to him now, the transparency is a hallmark of our intergovernmental system, is a hallmark of how we manage public finances. Now, what I was just telling the GM, and it's important that we, I have to check with DPE and ESCOM in terms of the conditionalities that are there. And I don't think it will be fair for any South African not to know. But, you know, I cannot now say this is what it's saying, and it's something that I think, let's give us maybe time, Chair, you know, we'll do that. As part of your response tomorrow, we should be able to give you a response once we've checked both ESCOM and... But it's important that there's a principle
I only asked on my own behalf, so to speak, on behalf of the committee, so to speak, but does the committee agree that it's reasonable for us to know what the terms are? Let's get that first. Is anybody disagrees with it? No, not discuss it here. What I'm asking is it not reasonable for a committee of finance to ask Treasury to let us know under what terms a loan has been secured from China? It's consistent with the rules, the norms, and the laws of the country here. Now, firstly, let me find out from the committee. Do we agree that's a reasonable thing to ask? There may be reasons why they can't reveal it, then just tell us what are the reasons in terms of which law. Yes, Tikileri?
Thank you, Chair. I have a humble request that maybe as a committee, I don't know if we were supposed to talk to this matter alone as a committee, that maybe we should change our strategy of putting things in the agenda. I know we have the pressure. We don't have the luxury of time. That we should have enough time to engage with the department. We should be able to unearth issues. We should be able to be satisfied, if necessary, with questions. We should be able to make follow-ups. When we get out of the meeting, we should be happy that we have been able to get sufficient information and try to limit the issue of writing, because it might be misused at some stage, Chair. And I'm saying I understand that we are under a lot of pressure. But as time goes on, let's try gradually to change that approach. Let's engage and get to the bottom of issues. Thank you.
Chair, if I'm long-winded or I'm speaking in parables, you have to forgive me. But I'm going to make an anecdote, maybe to make sense of what I'm going to say. You see, let's assume here it's two companies that are competing, and the other one is successful and the other one is not. And for the other one to succeed, it needs to know the strategies of the other. So what it's going to do, it's going to try and put people who can make sense of how are this one successful in different ways, at different times, at different places. Now, if you're going to get a loan or you're going to discuss a deal, you want to get a good deal, you're going to put your best ideas on paper. Now, the role of Parliament is not to understand on which terms and conditions you negotiate. We'll be interested to whether have you implicated us in figures that can relate to the economy. That's the part we're interested in. But once we're interested in those terms and conditions and strategies, it becomes very interesting. As to what are you representing now? What are you representing? And the observation I've made before about SAA in terms of people they hired as consultants and who possibly they were reporting to tries to give an impression that they represented their rivals. Now here we are again. And in terms of PAIA and the right of information, we should be able to differentiate what type of information we need and what do we need it for and which one. But once we discuss the terms, and we're encroaching on a right that does not belong to this institution in terms of its oversight responsibilities. The rents and cents, yes, will want to know how much did you negotiate, how much did you get, how much does it implicate the fiscus. But how you did it, Minister, it's not our problem. Can never be. And as parties, we continuously try our luck, and I get worried when we take that specific approach. If we want to know, did they get 10 billion rands, and over how long, that's fine. But there's certain information that is wanted here that we don't know where it ends, at the end, you know. Chair.
Fine. Mr. Benny, you want to say something?
Yes, Jane, just for the purposes of the written replies, I wonder if we could consider the reply to my question about the APEX appointments and the reply to my question about VBS Mutual Bank not to have been replied to, and if we could have replies in writing. It's not clear after hearing the DG whether there actually is a plan to fill the vacancies, and it's not clear to me after his reply that there actually will be an inquiry into National Treasury and or the regulators' actions in respect to VBS Bank.
I don't think there's any difference between what all the members are saying. We're simply saying that in terms of the constitution and laws of this country, in terms of the commitment to openness and transparency, which we as Parliament, not you the executive, have to hold you to account. Okay, you can't. It's within the law. Can you tell us what are the reasons for you not revealing the loan and its implications for ESCOM and this country and the budget? Future generations have to pay for it. So I think that's what we basically say. As to how you actually negotiated and all that, those things, insofar as you can keep it to yourself, there's some things you can indeed do, that's fine. So what Tandy and what I'm saying in Tandikla is no difference. Secondly, on VBS Mutual, can I just raise this, Mr. Mania? I did speak to the Reserve Bank Governor yesterday to speak to him about, and I spoke to National Treasury too, to speak to him about a date. I said the committee will decide on Wednesday, but the earliest it seems to me is after, because this is BRRR week. Next 2 weeks are MTBPS. We have no choice. So the first available date is the 7th of November. In principle, I said to him, I'll get a mandate on Wednesday. It's either the 7th or the 8th. He's come back to me to say this morning that he spoke to Advocate Mutal, and they think the 7th will be better because he has to be in the Constitutional Court. But I did raise with him that in our committee meetings, we have raised the question, all parties did, that actually there has to be some sort of overall, besides the investigation into who did what in VBS, all parties seem to agree that there should also be, Minister, an overall inquiry into the performance and role and interventions of National Treasury, SALGA in the case, and provincial associations of SALGA in Limpopo and Northwest, and the role of the regulator. Could they have intervened earlier? At the stage, I understood Kuben Naidoo to say, yes, there is an inquiry, a broader inquiry. I asked him yesterday, his reply was, yes, there is such an inquiry underway. In our committee's report, but it'll happen mostly next year. The main focus right now is what happened, can they rescue the bank? So what I'm saying in short is tomorrow, in our statement, what I suggest we do is we urge that this inquiry that was promised by mainly the Reserve Bank, but agreed to, it seemed to me, we can check the minutes or accounts of what happened then, Treasury should actually take place. Because all of us may have, in some or other way, had an opportunity to intervene early and we didn't. I think that's the point you're making. Mr. Naidoo says yes, Governor Naidoo says it's going to happen. Oh, Minister, I see you want to say something. Minister, did you want to say something?
Yes, I did, but you know, I'm new to these things again, so the Deputy Minister says he needs to say something first, and then he says I should speak last. We do things differently in the private sector, but anyway.
Minister, maybe on, I think the question of the exemplar is non-negotiable. That's the general understanding of the department. But I just wanted to emphasize the point that having analyzed all the irregular expenditures. We are convinced that there is nothing underneath which is untoward. It's a mere deviation from the required processes as prescribed by standards. But if anything needs to be explained, I think it will be explained. And again, DG has already responded that other questions will be responded to tomorrow. I don't know how DG was supposed to explain. At the apex level, there's a series of interviews that have been done, be it budget, policy, and so, almost all of them, OEG and so on, and then concluded what is awaited is DBSA, cabinet approval and so on. I thought DG was going to be able to say that. On the issue of SAA, I think it's best to ask DPA to deal with that. I'll explain why. Because honorable members are saying, if there are impairments, is there still value left and so on? There's a series of issues that find answers in the broader turnaround strategy, the progress to date in as far as SAA is concerned. In other words, you will be told about green shoots, which have been verified and correct. Now the extent is, to which extent do they deal with the consequences of the impairment that you speak about? We think DPE is a better place to actually deal with that. And I accept the principle of, I don't want to repeat the issue of transparency. Maybe we need to pay attention to the broader legalities of the entire matter and then come back to explain. I know if you there's a book written by Royal Court on the state-owned enterprise where they explain the contradiction between the need for confidentiality for commercial imperatives and also the state's responsibility to account to society with regard. Those are some of the issues that we need to look at. I don't think there's a debate on that. I think the issue of mislocation check was explained. That it was explained that this 360 something million in the 700 and something million, the reason it was actually noted as a finding and irregular is that an authorizing department, an authorizing document could not be located at that time until the auditing for that particular financial was finished. It got found and it's an authentic document, it does exist. How does then AG deal with us? I think there are particular principles of handling that, but it's not a secret, it's not a hidden story. It's there, it exists. On the PIC, the PIC, I think the chair has actually put it nicely, that there are two levels. The level is to deal with the direct disciplinary issues of individuals, which is not an issue of a broader inquiry. That one is being dealt with. The report is going to come very soon on that one. It's almost at the end. Two, the broader inquiry, which is in the hands of the what we call of the president. And I guess the minister will be able to handle that when he meets the president in terms of agency and so on. I thought it was important to again reassure the committee that we are committed to make sure that the department restores its obligation to be central, both in terms of example and leading on the principles of imperatives of governance. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I was saying that, I've been away from these chambers for a long time and spend my time in the private sector. One of the things that shocked me when I returned here was when the officials gave me a huge printed file of documents. And I said, are you people still using this thing of printed files? And they said, yes, they do. I said, I think you're a little bit behind schedule, because in the private sector, we use something called board pack. It's electronic communications. You don't have to carry documents around. It's in a little thing. huge documents are here. Maybe members of parliament should look into that. If there's a budget to make sure that every member has an iPad, so we'll stop this document flying around. Yes, you need to move, really, you need to move with times. A small little country like Rwanda pursues a paperless exercise, small little country. So I think you can do better if you move in that direction. One of the things I'd learned coming back here. The other thing that you learn in the private sector, which I'm sure can be useful in the government system as well, is that you can't do a rights issue in private. Rights issue, by definition, is a public exercise where a company raises capital in order to finance its activities. And I know in government, when we issue bonds every week or whatever it is, it's a public auction exercise. So I'm quite certain that anything that involves government contingent liabilities or whatever it is, it has to be publicly known. But I agree with the member there that the manner in which things are handled, one has to be careful about intergovernmental relations, but at the end of the day, everything else has to be in the books. I know why the chairperson might be concerned about China and loans, given the experience that one African country is going through now with China. But the Chinese are friends of ours. But even in friendship, you know that when a friend extends to you a loan, they expect a repayment. But the problem sometimes is that friends don't pay back. So you have to be careful about friends and family and loans. Doesn't quite work very well. So, but I'm sure it will be handled very, very carefully in this regard. Let me say something about VBS. Preliminary, we are going to have quite a lot to say, I think, next week when we do the medium-term budget statement. many things went wrong there. And I like the way the advocate prefaced his report about the robbery in Krugersdorp, where people had to tunnel their way to a bank and got away with 400,000 rand, and then they disappeared. Huge amount of hard work and planning for 400,000 rand. They were never found. These ones, for little effort, no tunneling, but they staged a huge bank robbery. I thought it was a wonderful way to put it. So the thing that the regulators really can hope for is that the law enforcement agencies move with speed to deal with the perpetrators of this bank robbery. With speed, no dilly-dallying, and they must move with speed, because we need to assure the public that we take their deposits very seriously and securely. So I think that has to be really, and the political parties have to move with speed to deal with any of their members who are found wanting. In this case, there should be no doubt about that. So, but I have to, being a former governor of the Central Bank, I have to explain a little bit about how the process works, very briefly, because we don't have time. So, the Registrar of Banks is responsible for the regulation and supervision of banks in terms of the Banks Act and other related regulations. A huge amount of trust is put on the internal and external auditors of the banks. There is no way in which the staff at the central bank will be everywhere, every time, all the time. So reliance is placed on the assurance from the internal auditors and the external auditors, and also, of course, the reports of the board of directors, the the audit and compliance committees of the banks and so on. But with respect to some of the larger institutions, well, during my time, the central bank had a capacity for what we called on-site inspection. They can't do on-site inspection to all the banks all the time. But some of the big banks, because of their impact, we had on-site inspectors. In this case, I must say that I think that we were failed by both the internal auditors, clearly in cahoots with management, and the external auditors. I can't give any sense of credit to the board subcommittee for audit and compliance, because they seem to have been part of the heist as well. So I think in looking overall at the experience of this bank heist, I think the central bank will have to bear in mind, amongst others, what they can do in terms of inspections for small banks. I think that's a lesson learned. But I'm sure this committee has discussed this thing. When we have a large auditing firm failing us in the manner in which that one has, it's an issue of serious concern. Very serious concern, which this country really should concern itself about. But nevertheless, we'll continue to do whatever we need to do. The second point I was going to make on the PIC, I know the Deputy Minister has spoken about this. I haven't had an opportunity as yet to speak to the President, but I can say that there is a preliminary report that was given to me yesterday by the Deputy Minister that is amongst the pile of documents that I have to read. You have to feel sorry for me about that. And that report does give some indication of what needs to be done. So in due course that will be made available. I'm sure you're aware as well about the interim report on SARS that has been made available by the judge, and again we're managing the process about what to do at SARS. We cannot afford mishaps at SARS. And I need to make that very clear, but the acting commissioner will talk about that just now. Finally, the new constitution that we negotiated after 1994 was on one hand premised on the need for greater democratic penetration in our society, having come from the apartheid past. And I learned something during that process from the lawyers called the vertical and horizontal relationship between the state and the citizens. I don't know whether I understand it very well, but that's what they taught me. So we assumed in many instances that the state was guilty before it proved itself innocent. And understandably, because we came from a point where the state abused the citizen. So you have to make sure as a state that you as clean as possible. Otherwise, we assume that you are guilty. And the issue of transparency comes in there, because the citizen wants to be able to trust the state. And the only way in which they can trust the state is by being as transparent as possible. But sometimes we have to be. When I was being sworn in as a minister, there was something like, I promise not to divulge or whatever it is, and so on and so on. So there has to be a balance. And I think all of us here have matured enough to understand that. But in conclusion, I just want to say that once I've settled in, I'm sure you'll give me the opportunity for a much more educated and informed conversation than this ragtag intervention I've just made now. Thank you very much.
Commissioner, over to you. DG will get the replies by 10 tomorrow, please. Eh? Thanks. Can we get going, Acting Commissioner? An in-house matter we can discuss while the Commissioner is making his way is we have to vote on this report by the 19th. Now, the 19th is on Friday, and one option is to vote on it on Thursday night. So after the House rises on Thursday, if we can have the report out, this will be our last BRRR report, and the main section will be on recommendations and observations. So I'm asking members if it's okay for us to meet after the House rises on Thursday, because several members have hinted that for a variety of reasons, Friday may be challenging. Is that agreeable? Right. So we meet on Thursday after the House. Thursday is a three-line whip. Is that right, Tanya?
No, Chair, can I deal with that part so that we check availability, including logistics?
Yeah,
then?
Fine.
But it's possible that we get.
Yeah,
it.
Okay, all right. But you know, thank you to everybody from the department who's leaving us. Over to the Acting Commissioner. Ah, the DM.
Yeah. Thank you. You are stuck with us today, Chair, for some time. I just want to highlight one or two issues on FAS that you might have heard that there is something on the print on the e-file. We will talk to that of SARS. And also, we will also be dealing with the issue of the replenishing of the IT infrastructure and what are we doing to deal with the gap, because we appreciate that we're almost more than 40% behind, but there will be an explanation on how we're dealing with that. Also the issue of regular expenditure, SARS, and we'll also deal with that on, because it involved the contract extension and how Treasury changed the rules and how we missed the mark as Treasury. We'll also be explaining to you the amount of that 102 million, much of it that has gone to bonuses. And of course, we'll be dealing with the issue of compliance with regard to returns, be it on the company income tax or how it is underperforming on the company side and what are the reasons it is performing on the personal income tax side. Generally, we'll be talking in a bigger picture with regard to those. Those are the issues that I thought I need to sensitize the committee. We'll actually be clarifying and engaging those issues. Mark will take you through on the details. Maybe introduction. Okay.
Commissioner, can you restrict yourself to half an hour at most?
I'm going to move as quickly as I can.
Thank you.
Chair, and good afternoon, Chair, good afternoon, Honourable Members, to my Minister and to my Deputy Minister. For those of you who don't know, today is Bosses Day, so I need to say to my bosses on my left and my right, Happy Bosses Day, for just stating that. Yeah, well, we had a great blessing on the first day I met the minister, which was last week, and that we had a outpouring of rain, which was a blessing, and we hope that continues. I think just very importantly, as we start off here, I want to echo, maybe in different words, the words that the minister said. We can't afford mess-ups at SARS. SARS is an important organization for our country. It is an organization that has to succeed. It has to do what is right and correct in every circumstance. I do believe that we are in the right direction. I do believe, though, we are facing choppy seas. And I'm going to go into a little bit of that in a moment. I would like, if you don't mind, I'm going to just mention my team that is here. I do have the chair of our Audit and Risk Committee, Mr. Sadi Garden, who is here. My Chief Officer of Finance, Mr. Johnson Kuba. My Chief Officer of Strategy and Communications, Mr. Slingani Matabula. My Chief Officer of Enforcement, Ms. Mkhola Mkhola. my acting chief officer of customs and excise, Mr. Bayes Taron, and my acting chief officer of business and individual taxes, where our branches are, Mr. Fabian Murray, just as by way of introduction. There's just a couple of things I want to make before I get into my presentation. I think everyone is aware that there's a commission ongoing, and I will be testifying on Friday. Some of my colleagues who are with me have already testified, and others will be testifying in the next few days. I will be testifying on Friday on a number of aspects with regards to their terms of reference. I think it's also very important, just to allude, and I'm not going into that. We are faced, obviously, I'm an acting commissioner, and we need to note that. The disciplinary, obviously, is something being handled from the presidency, but we need to take cognizance of that. In our midst here today, we do have the Chief Executive Officer of the Tax Ombud, and Advocate Makluana, who is with us here today, and I do want to recognize him, but I think it's important that we do recognize that we received their report last week for the previous year, the previous financial year. There are a couple of issues, one being the tax compliance system, and a couple of aspects that we need to look at. But very importantly, and I think it's important for the committee to be aware, you'll recall last year, I think towards the latter half, they issued a report on refunds. There were 12 specific findings in terms of refunds. 10 have been fully dealt with. 2 we put in measures to deal with, but they are being fixed. It takes a bit of time in terms of fixing the IT aspects relating to that. The last 2 specifically relate to what we call stoppers. We're putting in a new system which will manage the process better. We do have interim processes in place. And very importantly, lastly, was the splitting of the VAT and diesel account, where they rightfully identify that the two need to be split. We have got interim measures to give visibility to the diesel refunds, which has been one of the areas of complaints, but we will have that in place as we become GRAP compliant, and I'm not exactly sure the exact date of that, but to be aware of that. Some of the matters, and the Deputy Minister alluded to the issue of irregular expenditure. There's 2 specific items, and the total value is 102.4 million that has been highlighted as irregular expenditure in the year. The main amount relates to the acquisition or the variation on 2 agreements with 2 companies, BCX and Gajima, where in terms of the Treasury rules, which changed in May of 2016, we should have notified National Treasury as soon as we exceeded a 15% variance. We failed to do that. This was in June that this happened. And obviously we're in a process in terms of a condemnation thereof. And in that condemnation, we obviously have to make an inquiry. We have to ensure there's no corruption. And obviously there needs to be value for money. We do believe in those 2 that that was the case. The second aspect is a smaller amount relating to bonuses. Now, there's been 2 years with regards to bonuses, Chair. I'm not going to go into all the details. Safe to say that we were litigating both with the Auditor General as well as the Minister of Finance with regards to this matter. I have withdrawn those with agreement of the parties involved, and that litigation, together with other non-core litigation that we had, you've seen in the media some of it, Jacques Poe and all, Adrian Lacay, and there's others. We have terminated that litigation. We are trying to focus on our core mandate, Chair, to ensure that we deliver in terms of our mandate. Part of our key area, Chair, obviously is service. And one of the deliverables this past year, which we were supposed to have delivered on, was the service charter. We delivered finally on that on the 1st of July, which is in the subsequent financial year. And we believe that's an important stepping stone. Compliance is built on many facets. Yes, enforcement is one. But the primary building block of proper compliance is good service to our clients. And we need to understand that we need to improve in that area. There are areas, and I was just looking a few minutes ago, I think we had around 24,000 people had been received at our branches, and we got on the time, if I pick up now, I can pull up minute by minute data with regards to how many queues, people in my queues, 24,000 to 25,000 people in my queues been received this morning. We've managed to service about 14,000 to 15,000 of them so far this morning. But we are trying to get on top of the data that we can understand where our risks are, where our branches are that are struggling, and we believe that we're going to get there ultimately, and we believe if we serve better, we're going to have a far more compliant tax base, and I'm sure some of the members can agree fully with that. With regards to the matter that the Deputy Minister alluded to just now with regards to the newspaper, the Commission is hearing, and there's ongoing testimony this morning from people who used to be in our IT space who've subsequently left SARS. Yesterday there were some SARS employees who testified, and the headline this morning is that basically our IT system is going to collapse. And let me put it this way, I think that there are certain areas obviously of concern, but it's been misconstrued, I think, in terms of what was stated yesterday, but there are areas of concern. And I'll be the first to acknowledge there's a lot that we need to do in terms of fixing the IT space. And I want to just touch on two of the matters that came up yesterday in the Commission. The issue that was raised yesterday had to do with e-filing. I think some of you have seen on e-filing, when you see your tax return there, it is rendered on a technology called Flex, which is an Adobe product. And that product is reaching end of cycle. In other words, its lifespan is coming to an end, and the world is now on what we call HTML5, which is just a rendering language in terms of the documents. Interestingly enough, my team and I considered submissions actually a few weeks ago, and we've already agreed to move across for the filing season 2019 to HTML5. So it's almost system agnostic, and for those of you who've got iPads here, I heard the Minister speaking of iPads, it would be able to render equally there as it would be able to render on any, whether it be Safari, Explorer, Firefox, or whatever other type of system there might be out there, and it's far more efficient. Our danger is that it's not, we have to move away from it. And that is one of the critical things. The second critical issue that needs to be addressed in terms of our IT space relates to the refresh of our IT equipment. As you're aware, in terms of even your own IT equipment at home, you may keep a laptop for 5 years, but it gets slower and slower. We are currently running on Windows 7 as an organization overall, and you need to move the IT equipment to Windows 10. But some of our equipment couldn't do that at the moment. It would be in our best interest to refresh all our IT infrastructure in either a 20% per year up to 25%. In other words, 4 to 5 years, you need to be replacing IT equipment the whole time. And we are currently 2 to 3 years behind in terms of that cycle. And it is a risk. Now, there are various steps afoot, and we have reassigned finances with regards to this year, making up to $200 million available to start that process to ensure that that is done properly and that we can get on top of the IT risks that there are. And we believe that, and we're going to be asking for certain plans to deal with that, and we're hoping that over a few years cycle that we can get on top of this. But as we sit here today, I'm not worried that it's going to fall over tonight, but we've got to worry because our e-filing platform is the most important base for the submission of tax returns for our clientele. We have to make sure it works, but also we have to modernize it because it needs to be far more user-friendly. And I think as one member who's involved in practice can attest, if we make it easier on e-filing, you keep people away from the branches. And I've got long queues at some of our branches. We need to encourage people to specifically utilize those aspects in a far better fashion. Maybe just to touch on two other, or just one other area that was highlighted by one of the members. They asked for a post-audit plan. With regards to that, we do have one, and I believe it's going to be presented to me shortly, and I'm sure that we can make that available. I think that is important that we do so. With that, Chair, if you don't mind, I'm going to go into the presentation. if there are any questions. I'm not going to dwell on each slide. I'm going to go through very quickly. The annual report is there. It deals with a number of the outcomes that we obviously had to address. I think in terms of revenue is the key one where we were slightly short, and we'll touch base as we go through on those. But if I may just run through some slides, and some of my team are driving the program, and then we'll make ourselves available for questions. Obviously, we were slightly short, and interestingly, we had a 6.3% revenue growth year on year, and that was with a GDP growth of 1.3%. Also interestingly, filing season, a 94% filing compliance is on that first slide, and very importantly, and this is what we must sustain and obviously improve on, a 93.63% of returns were assessed within the 24-hour cycle. 2.7 billion, very importantly, fraudulent claims prevented. And that's an ongoing fight, Chair, that we have with people seeking to defraud us. We process probably closer to 2 trillion rand in any given year. So we are a target for fraudsters. And that's an ongoing fight that my team and case selection are very involved. Just looking at the volumes, if we move to the next slide, 17.2 million tax return submissions. It's a huge number, and obviously up from 16.6 million in the previous year. I'm not going to go into each one, but you know, people at our coalface are dealing with these things on a day-to-day basis, and often without recognition. And I think it's important for me, to the people who are manning the desks as we stand, personing the desks as we are here, who are taking calls at our contact centre, a whole 5.4 million inbound calls. That have been received, and obviously making outbound calls as well. These people need to be recognized and saluted for the work that they are doing. Very importantly, you will remember that we rolled out the new tax compliance status, and I think it was 1 April 2016, if my memory serves me correctly, that we rolled that out. And our desire was to get people out of our branch for getting tax compliance status certificates. And you'll see year on year there has been a significant reduction. It's not far enough for me. We're down to 1.18 million tax clearances requested. That's in total. We need to get the people out of our branch who are coming for paper copies. This is not the number, by the way, visiting our branches. But we've got a lot of people still coming for this into our branches, and we need to deal with that. If we move on to the next slide, it just gives a revenue overview. And obviously, on the right-hand side of the slide, the 0.8 billion that we were short of the revised estimate, and obviously 6.3, 72.4 billion up year on year from the 16-17 year. We have broken the variances per tax product down, and that is there for your information. Just very importantly, I think it's that we should just have a look at the third from last on the slide, on the left-hand side. It says DTSTC. It's dividends tax. STC obviously phased out a few years ago, and we are not making, even in this current financial year, which we are busy, we are not reaching the estimates that we envisaged in terms of dividends tax. Obviously, this is dependent on companies declaring dividends, and it's a self-declaration tax. Moving on to the next slide, it's dealing with outcome one, and it deals with customs and excise compliance. The figures are there, and I just wanted to touch on one figure there. Is on the top right-hand corner, we've got import VAT of 152.8 billion. Now, it's very important. Import VAT is normally refunded once the businesses bring those products and they get them into their business. It's collected at the port of entry, as import VAT, and then we would refund it once a business would claim it as an input on VAT. So just to note that, I think the figures are self-explanatory. You will note what was collected and the target in this environment and the shortfall in this environment of 1.49 billion rand. Moving on in terms of further with customs and excise compliance. Now, Chair, I know you're very passionate about the illicit economy as a whole. Obviously, illicit financial flows is a specific area, and we can touch on that at later, but these are just different figures with regards to other aspects of illicit trade as such, that we just wanted to reflect. We have got good news, and we do believe we're making significant progress with the illicit economy unit that we promised to you at one of our earlier sessions. In fact, they've already got over 80 cases, I think it was, or 50 cases, what do you call it? 58 cases that they're looking at. That is on top of those cases with regards to illicit financial flows, which we spoke to last time we were before the committee. You would have also noticed, which is also part of our concern, in the media this past week, that a couple of our officers were arrested with regards to facilitating trade in fuel, which was being diverted actually into the South African economy without the duties being paid. And the duties were quite significant, I think in the vicinity of 3 million, and they were seeking our staff to actually stamp the documents that the goods had actually left the country. So our primary concerns in the illicit economy, obviously tobacco, we see the figures that are bandied around, and I've got no way to defend that or say it's in any way wrong. That's 7 billion. Tobacco is a serious concern, and we've been doing certain things there. With regards to fuel, which I've just alluded to, and I think that's quite a significant number, and obviously it's got other impacts to the economy, such as the Road Accident Fund, which as soon as duty is not paid on that, they also impacted. And we understand their challenges in that regard. We have clothing and textiles as well. And our key worry with regards to clothing and textiles, obviously duty is important, but also the protection of the jobs within our economy. And we have to be looking out for that. We have had robust engagements recently with the trade unions and with the DTI, and we are focusing on certain of those industries to try and ensure that we target these areas. Obviously, drugs continues to be a major issue, and currency leaving, physical currency leaving our border posts is a specific focus of ours, and you'll see the one warrant of arrest was issued last week for somebody who didn't appear in court, who was taking around 9 million rand, but in US dollars, abroad in a backpack. And that person was identified by one of our risk teams in customs and excise team, and was pulled off the flight. Moving on to outcome two. This deals with increased tax compliance, and there was a small surplus of 0.6 billion there. Domestic VAT is there, and very importantly, the VAT refunds year on year were 5.2% up year on year. I'm not going to go into further details. I think that information is available for the members if they would like it. Moving on to outcome two, that is slide eight. I think the information that I'd just like to highlight there, and the Ombud has highlighted two new systemic investigations that are in process. The first one relates to the time that disputes are being taken to wind up, and secondly, with regards to the PAYE account. But just in terms of the debt book, you'll see that in appeals and objections, it's per type there. There's a thing heading with 53% called uncertain debt. Appeals 39% of it and objections 35%. And that is a link to the timelines with regards to disputes that we need to get on top of. And obviously, as soon as a person is in appeal or an objection, they do ask for suspension of payment. And that is obviously often granted, but there are some cases that we do enforce the pay now, argue later rule. But that is important, why we need to try and adhere to these timelines that are prescribed in the regulations pertaining to disputes. There are a number of figures further on that page with regards to investigative audit cases. 11,229 SMME audit cases done, 591 large business as opposed to 300 that we targeted, base erosion and profit shifting, which comes to the financial flows that is concerned, 39 of them, and high net worth individual case audits, 270 that are there. There's a number of other figures on that page. I'm not going to go into the detail. When we get to the heart of service on page 9, which is the ease of fairness of doing business, outcome 3, obviously we highlighted the fact that our call center agents are taking significant calls. It is interesting and that our customer satisfaction index with regards to the contact center remains high. Now, I am aware there are concerns that are expressed that people have got repeat calls. I'm not blind to that. And those are things that we need to continue to increase our skill sets and improve on our ability to answer the questions that are needed. Ultimately, I'd like taxpayers not to be calling us and to be able to self-serve, because that is the desire. You would prefer to get people to be able to handle the queries and not to escalate. Very importantly, and with regards to complaints, 26,820 complaints received, resolved within turnaround time, 58.2%, which is low, on the low side, and obviously it's our desire to move this up, and we have constant engagements with the tax ombud with regards to aspects, and I think we've worked hard in the last while to understand each other and to service these complaints in a better fashion. The average processing time is given there for PIT returns, CIT returns, and VAT refunds. And obviously, I know that people quote the magic number of 21 days with regards to VAT refunds. That is the day on which interest actually kicks in terms of the law. And there we are slightly shy, but we are seeking to improve that continually. Moving on then, increased cost effectiveness and internal efficiency. Now, one can see this in the top left-hand corner with regards to cost of collection is now at 0.89%. In other words, 89 cents it costs to collect 100 rand. Is that good or bad is a question. The world norm is around 1%. If you go look at an average, the cost of collection. So there is a challenge that we may be under-investing in terms of collecting, and we need to up that figure. And obviously that's part of our engagement with the National Treasury with regards to our allocation. In terms of procurement, our BBBE procurement, 43.18% black-owned entities, qualifying small enterprises, 16%. Black women-owned entities, 7.27%, and emerging micro-enterprises, 25%. Our procurement is extensive, 2.7 billion rand, and obviously that keeps my chief officer of finance awake at night. Moving on to slide 11, the cost effectiveness and internal efficiencies continued. I did highlight, and you'll see the top right-hand corner, I referenced that we've got data-driven decision-making. And if anybody wants to see it, I can show you here, I can pull up a whole score of dashboards which can give me live data, whether it be my branches, whether it be my refunds, my debt, my enforcement actions, what's the turnaround time, what are the timelines, etc. So we're becoming very data-driven, and the data analytics team have done a lot of good work in the last while to ensure that this data actually empowers us to service our client better on the one side and obviously collect the correct revenue. I'm not going to go in further on that page, but it's there for your information if there's anything that you would like to raise. Outcome 5, increased public trust and credibility. Our employee engagement did drop. And you'll see our target was 66%. It is below at 63.6%. I think in terms of the broader ongoings, and I think we're all aware of those, it is to be expected that the staff morale would drop and would be impacted on. And that is of concern to me. A motivated staff will obviously deliver in terms of the mandate, and we need to do all in our power to ensure that they are able to do what they need to do. The Leadership Effectiveness Index is listed there. We have been rolling out what we call electronic DNA, which is a taxpayer verification solution, and that basically enables us to interface with Home Affairs to enable us to validate who's sitting in front of you. It's from a security point of view. Very importantly, a big driver in revenue this past year has been the voluntary and the special voluntary disclosure program. It's listed there, 2,282 cases finalized, and it's a huge amount, Chair, of $5.4 billion that was collected through that program. And we're obviously continuing to work through those cases. As you know, the special BDP closed, and we're still processing some of those cases. But the normal BDP continues to be in place in terms of the Tax Administration Act, and we continue to get cases in that regard. Just for the record, this is on page 12 that we're on at the moment. As we move then further in dealing specifically with staff, the employment equity figures are stated there. Our headcount, Chair, has dropped. It's on page 13 to 12,801 permanent employees, 273 graduate trainees, and 305 seasonal workers. I think the members would recall at some stages we were well over 14,000. So just to be aware of that, the gender is set out there with 62% of our staff being female, and the demographics with regards to gender at management level, we had set ourselves a target of 48.9, we've achieved 48.78. With regards to disabilities, the target was 1.6, we have currently achieved 1.92%. We could move on to slide 14. I'm going to ask that my Chief Officer of Finance maybe take us through the slide, and I can just give my voice a break for a second.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Chair and Committee members. In as far as the first table is concerned, I think it's important to state that though we are seeing quite a favorable cost-to-revenue ratio, it is indeed concerning because it's reflective, at least in my eyes, of continued decline in terms of the grants that we're getting to be able to invest. And I think we are raising that with the DG at Treasury. If you look at the operating revenues that we got from Treasury, we got $10.2 billion to run our business, which was a marginal 2.1% increase from prior year. And if you then look at rendering services in terms of what accrued there, $11 million, and most of this come from the ATR, that service that we offer in that regard, and the total then that would have been available to us to spend in running our business, less of other revenue would have been $10.2 billion. If you look at other revenue, it's the interest received, as well as other income. That other income accrues from SDL and UIF. We provide a service and we charge a fee for that, and that accounts to that $443 million. So in essence, overall SARS has got $10.7 billion to collect $1,317 last year, accruing to the number of 0.89 that the Commissioner spoke about. In terms of what we had at the bank as of the 1st of April is $2.7 billion. And our workings in the year in terms of the deficit against the budget we had been given was $113 million, and we closed off the year with $2.6 billion. Of course, in the Auditor General's report, you would have seen that there was a few issues that were raised. In particular, the issue around misstatements. This speaks to the audit of performance objectives that were raised. In essence, this was not necessarily the values that we had given. It was the explanations and the variations that we had to give to the AG post-audit in terms of expanding the explanation on those variations for those performance outcomes. Expenditure, in the main, speaks about the bonuses that were paid. And I must state again that the 3 million that was paid in the other year versus the 4.3 million that was paid in the year under review. The 4.3 million, I think as SARS we had believed that we had obtained the necessary approvals from the minister, and the AG was of a different view, and we decided instead of fighting on the legal interpretation of Section 18.3 of the SARS Act, I decided to allow us to wrap up that part. Contract management, again, speaks to the two extensions that were effected, resulting in around 97 million rand in irregular expenditure. Commissioner, I think I've covered most of the aspects.
Thank you very much. I'd like to move on to slide 17 in the interest of time. With regards to, and I'm nearly done, Chair, with regards to tax compliance insofar as individuals is concerned, it is very interesting to start digging into the figures, but I want to focus on the middle set of columns and the right-hand set of columns. So returns required, if you see in the middle for the 2018 year, 4.319 million. Now, obviously, these might not be, because you don't know everybody who might have to or might not have to file. But these are our figures, and we've got a 94% compliance rate for PIT. But insofar as provisional taxpayers, it's less. It's at 88.4%. So provisional taxpayers are slightly less compliant. I think it's just interesting noting. But our PIT compliance, in our view, is significantly higher than the average compliance we're seeing in other tax types. And it is also driven that it is the only tax where we've got an administrative penalty that's applicable currently, and I'll get on to further. Very importantly, I'm going to jump to slide 19. And, Chair, there's been comments within in various engagements that at some point in the earlier year that we misled Parliament with regards to the compliance figures insofar as companies is concerned. And I wanted to just explain in a nutshell if one looks at these figures. We have a tax register as we're sitting today of companies of around 3.4 million. This is about a million more entities than the CIPC, the Company and Intellectual Property Commissioner, has on its record. We are working hard to reconcile these numbers because some deregistrations have taken place within the CIPC space, but people have continued to be on our register. We, a number of years ago, as part of our modernization journey, we did automate the registration, the auto-registration of companies. We intend to move it to the deregistration aspect as well. There are legal challenges. Because if a non-payment of a person of their annual license fee to the CIPC leads to deregistration, but the person's got an outstanding debt to us, we don't want to deregister that person. Because once you deregister, you do not have a legal entity to go after. You've got to go to court to get it reinstated. So we've reconstituted meetings with the CIPC Commissioner. We are working hard to reconcile this, and in fact, this number has come down significantly. But when we look at the 3.4 million companies that we have on our register, and we look coldly at them, we've got an 11.14% compliance rate. The challenge is, and members will know, that many companies, I've just alluded to the fact that we don't match in terms of the register with CIPC, but there are many companies out there that do not render returns because they're dormant. People established a company and they've left it. It was established for tender procurement purposes. They didn't win the tender and they just leave it then, and it's left to lie until a deregistration process continues. What we sought to do last year was to look at which are the economically active companies. And if you look on the right-hand field, which is the 979,724 for this year, which references the 38.26% compliance, which is still low. And the Deputy Minister said that that is not good either, and I fully concur with that. This year, the filing requirement for returns has been changed. Previously, all returns for every company had to be filed. This year, only active companies have to file returns for the 2018 and forward financial year. So next year there will be a change in the way this is measured. But we, for transparency's sake, want to be very transparent and say our total register, 11.8% compliance. Economically active, according to our definition, 38.26% compliance. There's nothing, we're not trying to hide this. It's a serious figure. We need companies to be compliant. Some of the tax gap is here. And for that reason, on the 7th of December this year, we will be implementing the administrative penalties for companies. And it's our intention that we will then start penalizing companies, and we are hoping to see a significant increase. We've got a whole marketing campaign that is being run out of our communications team, and with our BAPE team, we have written to the recognized controlling bodies and giving them a heads up that this is coming. And at all public fora that myself and my colleagues are attending, we are engaging in that fora to try and inform people with regards to their obligation. Chair, I think it would be good that I end there and leave it with you then to take.
Okay, members, questions? Dikeledi Tandi, Mr. Leith. Mr. Mania.
Thank you.
No more than 3 minutes each, I'm afraid. Yeah.
No more?
No more than 3 minutes, I'm afraid. But no. If you want to stay longer, I'm cool. Do people want to stay longer?
You are eating on my minutes, Chair.
No, it only starts once. Can I get some guidance? Do we want to finish at 13:30? All right, fine. 3 minutes, right?
Okay, thank you, Chair. And thanks for the directive. Chairperson, let me welcome the presentation. But also, I have asked the previous question when we were dealing with the treasure. I'll also focus on the findings by Auditor General. And I hear the presenters are saying there are few issues raised, but few as they may be, I find them very serious. And I believe that experience is a good teacher. Over and over again, as this committee, who has been concerned and trying to say to Treasury and SARS, it's not a matter of choice. They need to have a good and healthy relationship. And because of that relationship that they had, there has been bonuses to employees. And these bonuses have been issued without the minister's approval, which is contrary to Section 18.3. Section 18, subsection 3 of SARS Amendment Act of 2002. Chair, on the same issue again, there were no effective steps taken by the executive to prevent irregular expenditure, which is amounting to 4,352,000 rands. And that is a call for concern for me. But then, it's not just something that should have happened. It isn't the PFMA. Section 51, subsection 1B, Roman figure 2. It is also highlighted by the Auditor General, according to their findings, that a contract was extended without the approval of National Treasury. All these things, they are surrounding, they are revolving around the unhealthy relationship which was there between Treasury and SARS. And these things have caused us problems, and they are denting the image of SARS.
the National Treasury. So I think we have learned a lesson. We will understand our obligations and not do what we think is right, because there will be no consequences. Thank you, Chair. I hope I've not wasted your time.
Can I get something clear? I'm happy to stay till 13:30. I'm just wanting to know, you've got to guide me so we can have more time. I'm happy to stay till 13:30. So let me know. Who's next? Tandi.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, there's this 1 million shortfall from the budget expectations that you needed from National Treasury. I'm interested to know how are you going to plug the hole. And I wish National Treasury was here so that you can ask them, but if they need this much and you give them this much, what's going to happen? Now they're not in the room, so maybe there's a way that you're going to deal with this. But the Deputy Minister is here, fortunately, maybe you might want to say how are you going to help them, because they need that 9.99 to be able to deal with their services. So you gave them 1 million short. You only gave them 2%. Well, I know we approved it. I don't know. We did that. But also, I'm worried about the misstatements, because this matter has been before us, and at some point SARS has been saying, no, but you have not been misstating our statements. But here it comes. So maybe there's a better explanation as to why was there misstatement, and we deal with that. But Chair, there's an issue of PIT versus CIT in terms of its compliance, and it's sad because if you look at how we impose our tax models, we tend to impose more PIT as opposed to CIT, and yet when you look at compliance levels, you find business wanting in relation to compliance. It's not only to be the issue of penalties. Now you also have this situation where CIPC takes a different approach in terms of digital registering companies that has not performed, but there's an economic performance on the other side. I think we need a vibrant and a more active way on how we're going to relate with the policy perspective of CIPC as opposed to what we want to achieve. Because records are going to be cumbersome in relation to how you're going to track companies that are still active. And as we all know, that business tends to avoid paying taxes. They're going to come with very creative ways and means to try and even avoid further, because if we don't diagnose it properly, to me, it's not only an issue of deregistering. I think it's part and parcel of business to avoid taxation by out of nowhere making their companies to be dormant and re-establishing them under different names. So to me, it's not just the fact that CIPC has deregistered them. They deliberately want to be deregistered so that the company is dormant and then they re-establish in a different name. By the time we try to check for collection purposes, it has become more expensive for SARS to do that as opposed to them being compliant. So we need a very proactive way on how we're going to deal. So we need a different model altogether that you apply for CIT as opposed to any other tax model that you have. So perhaps you might want to look at that, and then in future we see how it performs and how it can impact for it to have a relevance in terms of, well, I wish we can give these figures to industry, because there are those who believe CIT can perform better. Of course it doesn't. They don't believe in these figures. Maybe if they can see them in real terms, they will understand why we take certain policy position in terms of taxation. Because if we were listening to the engagements when we're dealing with the issues of VAT, there were people who had an impression that CIT can perform better. So they need to be shown these figures, maybe the public discourse or in your engagement, for them to understand the impact in terms of our revenue collection. But the one that stands out, it's 48 billion shortfall, 1 million bonuses. Really, I don't know. I can't say much, but really?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner, and your team. Not too many questions, really. You've dealt with the tax ombud, so that's great. Just in terms of an earlier subject in the day, the VBS report on page 138, there's a recommendation from Advocate Motar to for the SARB to refer tax issues to you. Has that happened? And if so, what sort of action are SARS busy with? The question of exec bonuses has been dealt with, and you've reported litigation has been withdrawn. But even, let's put aside the litigation, in terms of what the ministerial approval that you understood had been granted, on what basis were these bonuses calculated? I mean, I don't understand. Someone was the CEO of Business and Individual Taxes, acting for 5.5 months, got a bonus of $566,000 against a salary for the president. And I can't find your position there. Why I'm saying this, it's not so much the amounts actually, but it is partly. But the previous year, the whole question of the minister then, Gordon, saying no bonuses at all, was that then, putting aside the difference with the Auditor General, the next year the minister said go for it, whether it was done properly or not properly. Was there that change from one year to the other where the minister, different ministers, had different views about bonuses? The question of IT is short. I mean, I use Apple, what's it called? I can't remember what the search engine's called or whatever. And Safari, there you go. You see the DOS. Yes, well, mine is probably is DOS. I can't open letters. I can open returns and sometimes assess, but I can't open correspondence. And the call center says to me, "Well, go and open it in Chrome," and I don't have Google Chrome. I'm glad to hear that you're dealing with it. Tandy and the Peanut Gallery, I appreciate the encouragement. Thank you. Okay, in terms of the quite a critical thing is the CIT, the number of entities on your register versus who's actually dormant and so on. So there seems to be quite a bit of consternation in because of your campaign, and quite rightly, that we now have to go and find out how many tax returns are outstanding for an entity that might have been dormant for 10 or 15 years. And how does one do that on the system? Because you know the system better than I, but you go onto the system, you call up a particular taxpayer, and there's the tax status, and it's almost unusable, to be honest, to establish exactly which tax returns. And so you're going to generate a whole lot of extra revenue and penalties, and perhaps that's your objective and nothing else. They're all shaking their heads. I mean, I really think that there needs, in terms of your education campaign, of some kind of guidance note as to how to access what's outstanding or what needs to be submitted. Last year we were told that the dividends tax was, people rushed and did it before the end of the tax year, and that affected this tax year. But it seems now that you're saying to us that actually it's just a general decline in dividends tax. Is that really what you're saying, or am I misunderstanding you? Can you just brief us, or just a quick word, as to what's happened with the CCMA constructive dismissal application from Makwakwa? Is that history? Where are we with that one? You've spoken about staff matters and skills and so on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair. I have one quick question. Is there an intelligence unit within SARS, or is there a SARS intelligence unit within the State Security Agency? Thank you.
Except that this compliance figure of CIT, I hear what you're saying, you're not sure the exact number we should be paying, of 38% or thereabouts?
Economically
active, right. So isn't that figure remarkably low? And can you, by 10 o'clock tomorrow, in a pretty way, just give us four or five, you said something, but we'd like to cover what you're saying. See, what our report does, if you haven't noticed, is we first give an overview of what you said, and then put our observations and recommendations. We prefer that you speak in your own words. So can you tell us, you know, in sort of like a third of a page, what exactly you're doing about this thing, what are your timelines and deadlines, and maybe a line or two about why the problem exists in the first place. Okay. Then the next thing is, well, look, I'll forego my questions for now. If need be, I will email them to you. Right. Answer them, please, those that have been put to you.
Well, firstly, thank you very much, Chair, and to the honourable members, thank you for the questions, and I'm going to seek to answer. I think the seriousness of the irregular expenditure is very much on my mind. It was probably the biggest issue that worried me in terms of this. It worried me further that we sought to litigate about it, which litigate with my own boss, and that is not something that I'd like to do. We take it seriously, and we put in place measures that it doesn't repeat. Now, I can't say there will never be anything. We do not know what will be found. And obviously, there's also allegations, as you're very well aware, with regards to the contract with regards to Bain, which has been in the public domain. And even if you go read in the media with regards to other contracts with regards to the operating model and the changes that happened there. So I can't say there'll never be, but I can assure the Honourable Member that this is a serious matter. It's not something I take lightly, and my colleagues and I believe that we've put in place the checks and balances that will prevent such future occurrences. I'm not sure what will still be found in terms of processes, but we believe that we are treating it with all the seriousness that it is needed. The contract extension matter, yes, we dropped the ball with regards to not implementing the 1st of May 2016 change in having to notify Treasury. We should have done that. And we dropped the ball. But those are things that we were notified on time. We can't plead ignorance. We were notified in terms of that. There are a number of other questions, and I'm going to ask if, just that my colleagues prepare themselves. In terms of the broader compliance questions, I'm going to ask that the Acting Chief Officer, Mr. Fabian Murray, just deal with that. With regards to the shortfall in terms of allocated, our Chief Officer of Finance, if he could just comment on that. I'll comment on one or two others and ask if there's any other input from my colleagues. But let me just speak to the other matters very briefly that were highlighted. The issue of the VBS, we received the report the day before it was publicly released. I immediately, in fact, the same day, prepared a note instructing our governance processes to be ready once it was released publicly, and that's gone into that process. We go through a strict governance process for case creation, etc., and that is underway. Beyond that, we can't get, Chair, into any detail, because if it's Mark Kingan's affairs there, there is a confidentiality. But I can assure the members, I am doing what is right, and my team and I will do what is right in this regard, by the book. My concern is obviously not whether money was taken, it's whether it was taxed correctly. And that's for me, even if a person incorrectly takes money, I still want my pound of flesh. I'm a tax man at heart. I need to make up that money, Honourable Member, in terms of that. Just in terms of the exec bonuses, obviously the ones reported here are the ones that relate, that were paid out in the 17-18 year, but they related to performance in the 16-17 year. So I just you need to understand it in that context. These were paid probably August or so last year, the amounts that are reflected here, and that's why you will not get my name here, Honourable Member. And with regards to why the acting chief of BAIT, it was actually a person who was fulfilling another role would have got a performance bonus in any case of those roles, and one needs to understand that. With regards to the penalty note, and I'm going to ask, as I've said, Fabian Murray to comment, but I did want to say one thing. I don't expect you to go find which returns are outstanding. We're actually going to notify the individual companies. So there is a process underway that we'll do it by the book. And as the chair has asked, we're going to give a short synopsis of this, because that figure of below 40% compliance, even of economically active entities, should shock us. It's not acceptable, and we need to deal with it. But we are notifying the people. They will get formal, each one will get a letter, the public officer. Obviously, where we've got the contact details, because some of them are gone, and you're gonna struggle in terms of that. With regards to the CCMA of the Jonas Makwakwa, the last information I have is that he asked for condemnation for late submission, and that was turned down by the CCMA. So that is the information I have. With regards to the intelligence unit, the question that was asked in that regard, I don't know, Ms. McCall, if you'd like to comment on that, but I'm not aware of any intelligence unit in the legal sense of an intelligence unit operating either in SARS or at the SSA for SARS. And I just want us, if she can maybe just clarify that in a moment. Obviously, we gather information on taxpayers. Case selection is based on information from taxpayers. That's not an intelligence unit, I think, as the member is alluding to. It's the intelligence unit as in that other act pertaining to. Whether we should have some form of intelligence thing, I'm not going to go into, but we do need. Tax crime is a very serious issue. Illicit financial flows, the Honourable Chair has highlighted it. You need intelligence to be able to tackle these things, and we need to be able to do it properly. It's on my agenda as to where we go forward on this, but we're going to operate by the book, within the law, proper governance, and ensure that we are accountable for whatever we do in this space. But I'll ask that the Chief Officer Enforcement maybe comment.
Can I just read something there? Memory, the members of this committee, I'm one of the oldest, but they have very short memories. But our position has been, unless it's changed, we can change it. Our position has been that we think that there should be an appropriate intelligence unit within SARS, within the law. It must act on illicit economy. When the commissioner was here in G26, I put a question to him, do other revenue-raising agencies have an intelligence unit? His reply, as I recall it, yes.
Correct.
So we said, have this. It is the view of this committee. In fact, it might even be in the reports, Alan, you can trace it. That's our view. But while we're at it, there's something else we need to clarify. Can you tell us why you withdrew Adrian Lacaze's case? So that we're clear.
because there's a lot of confusion about this in the public domain. I had to reply following endless prodding by journalists. I think it's reasonable to say that some of us, at least, we never discussed this formally, were ill at ease about the decision to take him to court over letters he wrote to the two committees. But we were told that in terms of the employee's relationship with the SARS, within SARS, that letter was inappropriate. So on the one hand, you have a law that we've passed that we are told he had violated, in which case, whoever it is, they must face the music. On the other hand, we felt ill at ease that he had written to two committees. What he expected of the committees, we can agree to disagree. We couldn't do it. Intelligence Committee had to handle it, right? But we must agree to disagree. We had endless exchanges with him, emails and phone calls, several, between Connie September himself and myself. But finally, you know, in discussion with various people, we realized that Skoff can do little. So we must agree to disagree with him. But the thing is that we were in an ambivalent position. On the one hand, you have a law, correct, that we passed, or maybe it was passed in the pre-democracy era, which prevents an employee from doing it. On the other hand, he wrote to two committees, and he got penalized for that. So it was a strange relationship. So maybe you can just clarify, so that the committee in future, if ever such a thing, hopefully it won't recur, we've got some guidance about, you know, how we manage these things also. We must decide for ourselves, but why did you withdraw it in a nutshell?
Well, Chair, primarily, I don't want to be caught up in litigation that is non-core. That's my biggest issue. My core mandate is to collect revenue. Now, you will be aware we had other incidents of information being passed in terms of other books, for instance, that were published. It makes it very difficult. How do I disprove or prove? I need to make information available. And it gets into a very tricky thing when I start debating what's right or what's wrong in terms of some detail or not. The second part is Mr. LeCay had actually won a cost order against SARS at one point in time. And it was just in our best interest to clean that up and move on. I can give you a formal written report on it, and which I'd be happy to do, just to clarify that. But the key thing is I want to focus on my mandate. I don't want to be distracted with taking on a person like Jacques Poe, for instance, or other people, even Adrian LeCay. We don't want to be in the media for that.
Committee's sake for now. We will take a position on this. Can you write in a few lines why you withdrew the two cases?
100%. Right?
The committee can then take its position. On Adrian LeCay, it's easier because we must maybe express in our observations the ambivalence of it. Somebody writes to a committee, and then that person is taken to court for that, right? But on the other hand, if the law says he or she can't write to anybody, including Parliament, that was an open letter. If he'd written confidential letters to us, maybe it would have been easier to defend him, right? So, but we need clarity on this issue. What we have to also ask ourselves, colleagues, is could this committee have done more than it did? In fairness to Mr. LeCay, I can't see that it could have, right? I've consulted again 2 weeks ago, Tandi, in his constituency. I haven't spoken with you. I need to confer with you on that matter. But, you know, we need some clarity on that for our own selves. But Mr. LeCay, Commissioner, there are other things that you need to know. This committee has held a view that we need to amend the SARS Act to provide for certain circumstances in which, in a closed meeting, like the Intelligence Committee does, we have the right to inquire. If there are reasonable allegations in the public domain, reasonable, that's the criteria, we have asked the lawyer to look into this, Advocate Jenkins. Nati Anoti, I'm just reporting, this is before your time, Nati. So that the person accused or the company accused can appear before the committee with its lawyer, the committee can ask questions. We sworn in terms of the Intelligence Committee, in a closed meeting, we must deal with this thing. Because there are too many accusations made about people not paying taxes, and maybe they are paying their taxes. On the other hand, there are people who are accused of not paying taxes who probably aren't paying taxes. We think of this famous family as one example, right? The rumors have been circulating since 2011. I heard in 2011 that they were not paying their taxes, right? And this thing became a big issue. Look where we are right now, the Zondo Commission, right? And what I'm trying to say is, and you know, I was out of the country last week. Colleagues, the way we appear in the international media, you cannot recognize our country, really. It is so bad, right? If you look at all the papers, right? So I think these are things we have to do in the next five-year term. But unless members have changed their views, we must, in our exit report, put this down. And I think in this report, Zakele, Antonia, we should put these issues down. That these are issues the committee thinks should be considered by the incoming five-year term committee. Nati.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. I just want to make a comment on two issues that are largely process-related. I support the Chair in terms of what the Commissioner needs to do, but we need legal reasons to be advanced. We don't need preferences and options. It's a preference to say, I don't want to be caught up in non-core issues. That's a preferential kind of statement. We need the legally sound kind of reasons why these cases were withdrawn, for an example. So that's why. Because it would also be incorrect for us as a committee to largely base ourselves around issues of options and preferences, really. You know, that's not how to deal with the governance issues. The second area is it's a broad kind of issue in relation to a number of undertakings and initiatives that are being undertaken, you know, investigations on this, a commission on that, and so it goes. My reservation generally is that whether it's at VBS or the commission on tax matters and so on, or even the state capture commission and stuff, we tend to make statements that begin to sound like determinations, but we also ask these commissions to make determinations. You know, determine that which we have determined. I mean, we can't work like that. If you put a commission, you put a commission in order for that commission to establish certain facts about a particular happening. And then we must come back to the issue of how we then begin to process issues that would have been unearthed by a commission or any investigative kind of matter and so on. And then we pronounce ourselves quite properly and stuff. So I fear that sometimes as a committee and generally people as different sort of role players, you know, involved in these particular matters, we begin to make statements that essentially about issues that would still be subjected to investigations. I mean, VBS is one case in point. So I think the Minister of Finance alluded to some preliminary reports, including the PIC reports that he's beginning to receive. And for me, I think it's correct to then say, let's begin to consume such reports and begin to process them from a structured point of view and stuff like that. Otherwise, we're going to be tripping. It's just a general concern that I want
to... Yeah, no, you're right. So in fact, that has been the general thrust of the majority in this committee. But I think Nati's right. What you could do is just explain the legal basis, and then you have the right to make options. Like anybody, a DG, a minister, we can tell you we don't agree with it, but you can do both. That means do what Nati is saying, provide the legal basis, and then... because this is our last BRRR report, you know, members, can I ask for a mandate, man, that I approach the House Chair and say, look, we've never failed to deliver our reports in the last 4 years on time. But this thing of trying to squeeze it in by Friday... Now, you remember, the original idea was to meet last week. But then the minister's office explained that they're all in Bali. Myself also, I had to go as a Bali. Well, I didn't have to. I would have decided to do what I have to do. I would have gone for a day or so because I had to do a report. But I didn't have to stay for all 4 days, right? So
But then they said nobody's going to be around, because it's correct. Unfortunately, there are two meetings, the April meetings and October meetings. They clash. The October meeting clashes around this PR, the BRRR thing. So, you know, instead of rushing the report, is it okay for me to approach the House Chair and say the committee met and said that whether we deliver the report by Friday, which is the deadline, or next Tuesday, what difference is it going to make, right? Goes back to the earlier point, which I lost out on, that annual reports, where's the department? There's not a single department official here. It's Cindy here. Cindy, this thing we come back to, which is the thing we should repeat, you know, that they must submit their reports not at the end of September. We've said at the end of August, right? Then you remember National Treasury gave 1,000 reasons why you can't do it, and the members sold me out. Nati, the members sold me out, right? Cowards, right? They got scared of more of them. I think we'll still go back to this. Because, you see, now we rush these reports. And they meant to have an impact, Nati, on the MTBPS, which is already shaped. So it's like a mechanical roll, right? In other words, the MTBPS outline has been done a month ago, right? And then we submit our reports, right? So that is also something, can we repeat? There's nothing wrong with repeating our report, that we feel serious consideration should be given. It's a draft, comrades. You all can reject it. Between Zakele and we'll do the draft. You're the majority. Then I'll say I told you so 10 years from now. Okay. Oh, no need to respond.
Okay. Yeah. No, just very important. Yeah. We will provide the legal reasons. There is a legal framework for those decisions, and we'll provide those. Just with regards to then, I wanted to touch on one other thing, then I'm going to ask Mr. Murray to come in. The key issue which was highlighted is relationship with Treasury, and we've been working very hard at that relationship. And I want to assure the Honourable Member that that has been one of my mandates, to try and ensure that we build up the relationship with all state organisations, whether it be the company's office, which deals with the issue we're talking about now, National Treasury, etc., and we are working hard at that. I want to ask Mr. Murray to come in on the compliance, then Mr. Makuba to just deal with the financial aspects, and lastly just Ms. McCauley in terms of the intelligence unit.
Acting Commissioner, Chair, Honourable Members, I'm going to give a little bit of context with regards to compliance, and specifically around the discrepancy around PIT compliance and CIT compliance. I think PIT, the reason why we're seeing PIT being at the 90% compliance level is that PIT is one of the first taxes when we modernized SARS, and we're speaking about 2007, 2008, that was the very first tax that we actually modernized. And since then, up until about 2014, you know, we continued to modernize, and PIT was one of the dominant taxes. So if you look at PIT from a register perspective, from a process perspective, from imposition of penalties, that is all in place. And therefore, it's obviously yielding the results in lieu of a modernized process. CIT, it's a tax type that we started only more recently to modernize, and therefore it does trail. But I think our single biggest challenge that we have with CIT is around the accuracy of the registers. And for the first time that we're doing something meaningful to address that. So we have a direct interface with CIPC, so we get information from them and we understand exactly what's on their registers. The Acting Commissioner alluded to the fact that they have about 2 million on their registers. We're sitting with about 3.4 million. You know, we've exchanged information and we're quite confident. And I think it's the first time that we can confidently say that we will address the CIT compliance issue. Okay, we will address it. We've had, CIPC gave us about 500,000 corporates that they would like to deregister on their side. We've cross-referenced it with our database. And again, the Commissioner mentioned this too. It's not as simple as just taking the 500,000 from CIPC and deregistering it. Because the corporates might have assets, they might have debt, and therefore we can't deregister, despite the fact that they've approached CIPC and they want to deregister. Because they have assets or debts, we can't. But the bottom line is about 400,000 of those we were able to agree, and therefore they've been deregistered. So we are quite confident with the work that's taking place. that we will get the register sorted out this year. And therefore the compliance level should see quite a substantial improvement next year. And we'll build on that. So each year we'll build on it. So that's something that the team is quite confident that we will get sorted out. So yes, that's then with regards to the compliance. And then also a big incentive is that for the first time, now that the registers are accurate, because we couldn't impose penalties with an inaccurate register, it would create mayhem. But with the confidence that we have that the registers are accurate, effective 7 of December we go live and we impose penalties. Okay? And with the imposition of penalties, that also drives the right behavior. So we are confident with the internal activities that is happening and with the imposition of penalties, we will get the CIT register sorted out. And therefore, compliance will improve with regards to CIT.
Okay, thank you very much. We've got about 5 minutes left. Who's next?
Good afternoon, everybody. As the Acting Commissioner has indicated, I am the Chief Officer of Enforcement. I will try to address, there are actually two questions that I'd like to address. The first one relates to the existence or otherwise of an intelligence unit. There is no such thing, to my knowledge, at SARS, but that's not to say the use of information, of reliable information for effective enforcement is not acknowledged. It is important. I think the word intelligence has acquired a certain negative meaning, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with relying on intelligence to craft our enforcement strategy, as long as the information is reliable and we don't abuse it and it's subject to proper governance. So that's quite important just to note. And also more importantly, we didn't have time to update the committee, but we are setting up an illicit economy unit and quite key to tackle the various manifestations of illicit financial flows, such as phoenixism or peppering of the tax system, where people abuse the liquidation and business rescue practices to sort of liquidate companies when they're in debt and then bring them up again, or if they've been identified for fraud, then they'll sort of kill the company and bring another one to life. So that's one of the focus areas. But in order to be able to address those kinds of things, intelligence or information or data, whatever you want to call it, is very important, and hopefully one day we'll be able to share with the committee the unit and the structure of the unit. You'll see in there that quite key is a research and analysis team that will be centered around desks. We'll create desks with different focus areas so that, you know, because it's important to move with agility, and you can't do that if you still have to go back and try and understand the trends. So we'll be doing research into non-compliance trends to enable us to be effective in enforcement. So, you know, maybe some people don't like the word intelligence, but, you know, we do have to rely on information. As long as it's done properly with governance in place, which is quite robust, that the governance that we put in place, we should be fine and minimize any kind of risk of abuse. So I should just give that context, and also just to allay your fears, we are aware of that particular problem where people abuse the tax system, and that's one of the focus areas, including fuel and smuggling of all sorts of things like rhino horns. We'll be focusing on that. Thank you.
Who's next?
I think I'll probably address the question quickly on shortfalls and assisting the DG at Treasury. Of course, we speak at ROC. We do project where we're sitting and why we're sitting where we're sitting, whether it's economic performance or other factors. So he doesn't necessarily get shocked when these things happen. But I think the case in point is the recent ROC, where we said to them, look, we see the economy performing the way it's performing. We'd like to leverage our debt book to try and assist. And we've clawed back a couple of billions within the debt book, within reason, to try and make sure that we deal with whatever we are projecting as ROC going into MTPPS. So I can give you an assurance that when there is a shortfall, we do talk to see how we help each other. I think you also linked it to bonuses. I think it's also important to accept that the performance measurement system in the organization is a balanced scorecard approach. It's not on one dimension. Even if it were on one dimension, it would scale within a range. such that if you are not able to meet certain targets by 1%, it does not go binary 0-1. And that performance approach gets approved upfront before the financial year starts, and we then measure against that. But in terms of the shortfall, I think that's important. We do engage with Treasury. We've got a policy, tax policy meeting on a monthly basis with Momo and team, where we then escalate certain issues to ROC, where we align. Thank you.
Chair, if you'd allow me one thing we forgot to brief you on, and I'm going to ask Mr. Matabula just to brief you on the large business.
Chair and members, I'll brief. This has been one of the things that has been promised to this committee. And we did manage to announce that we're re-establishing the large business center. Where we are now, I am sitting with a presentation that EXCO needs to be able to approve, but essentially, by the 30th of December, we should have an interim solution. That interim solution will be constituted by having to second staff into that interim solution by virtue of the portfolio that they headed before, or other sections that we have put through that EXCO must approve. It is intended that that interim solution either will be converted into a permanent solution, or a slightly different solution to that will be in full effect on the 1st of April 2019. The naming convention will not necessarily be large business center, but will probably be a large taxpayer office or center. The reason why we're going a large taxpayers center is because the large business was ignoring or not giving expression into the naming convention of the fact that whilst there is the business side, there's as well the high net worth individual that you need to give enough focus into, who are critical in the collection of our revenue in that space. I think that chair should suffice for now.
Can I ask a question? That's
No, it's Natalie. If you do, then others are.
You
if
might
it's
be
30 seconds.
Yes. Chair, I wanted to ask the acting commissioner whether safety measures have been put towards people who appear in front of the commission.
Their security is at risk. If you say certain things in the commission, I think that's your point, you can be vulnerable.
We are very aware of it. Is there somebody specific that we're doing? We're very open to engage with our staff. I've spoken to the staff specifically. Some of the things that have come out, they might be threatened, and they haven't been to my knowledge as yet. But we are very aware of that as an executive. We've supported them throughout the process. And if there is specific threats, I have staff available to deal with those threats if need be.
Knowledge, they can communicate with the commissioner. Right, no, I'm just saying. Yeah. Okay, the next quick thing then is we're done. Thank you very much. Can the ANC comrades just remain behind for a second?
Before they leave, Chair, I think the team is not balancing.
Yes.
There's only one woman.
Yes.
Can you please address that?
Right, that will be in our report. Also, while we're at it, the first part that you gave an input on, the IT stuff, can you write a few lines about that? Mr. Matabule's input, a few lines. So we put what you're saying in your words, and then we say what our observations and recommendations are. Okay, can we have all of that, any case, by 10 a.m. tomorrow? Thank you very much. Right, members of the ANC,